The Pioneers, or, The Sources of the Susquehanna. Chapter 1. See, winter comes, to rule the varied years, sullen and sad, with all his rising train, vapors, and clouds, and storms. Thomson. Near the center of the state of New York lies an extensive district of country whose surface is a succession of hills and dales, or, to speak with greater deference to geographical definitions, of mountains and valleys. It is among these hills that the Delaware takes its rise, and flowing from the limpid lakes and thousand springs of this region the numerous sources of the Susquehanna meander through the valleys until, uniting their streams, they form one of the proudest rivers of the United States. The mountains are generally arable to the tops, although instances are not wanting where the sides are jutted with rocks that aid greatly in giving to the country that romantic and picturesque character which it so eminently possesses. The vales are narrow, rich, and cultivated, with a stream uniformly winding through each. Beautiful and thriving villages are found interspersed along the margins of the small lakes, or situated at those points of the streams which are favorable for manufacturing, and neat and comfortable farms, with every indication of wealth about them, are scattered profusely through the vales, and even to the mountain tops. Roads diverge in every direction from the even and graceful bottoms of the valleys to the most rugged and intricate passes of the hills. Academies and minor edifices of learning meet the eye of the stranger at every few miles as he winds his way through this uneven territory, and places for the worship of God abound with that frequency which characterize a moral and reflecting people, and with that variety of exterior and canonical government which flows from unfettered liberty of conscience. In short, the whole district is hourly exhibiting how much can be done, in even a rugged country and with a severe climate, under the dominion of mild laws, and where every man feels a direct interest in the prosperity of a commonwealth of which he knows himself to form a part. The expedients of the pioneers who first broke ground in the settlement of this country are succeeded by the permanent improvements of the yeoman who intends to leave his remains to molder under the sod which he tills, or perhaps of the son, who, born in the land, piously wishes to linger around the grave of his father. Only 40 years have passed since this territory was a wilderness. Our tale begins in 1793. About 7 years after the commencement of one of the earliest of those settlements which have conduced to effect that magical change in the power and condition of the state to which we have alluded. Very soon after the establishment of the independence of the states by the peace of 1783, the enterprise of their citizens was directed to a development of the natural advantages of their widely extended dominions. Before the War of the Revolution, the inhabited parts of the colony of New York were limited to less than a tenth of its possessions, a narrow belt of country, extending for a short distance on either side of the Hudson, with a similar occupation of 50 miles on the banks of the Mohawk, together with the islands of Nassau and Staten, and a few insulated settlements on chosen land along the margins of streams, composed the country, which was then inhabited by less than 200,000 souls. Within the short period we have mentioned, the population has spread itself over 5 degrees of latitude and 7 of longitude, and has swelled to 1.5 million of inhabitants, who are maintained in abundance, and can look forward to ages before the evil day must arrive when their possessions shall become unequal to their wants. It was near the setting of the sun, on a clear, cold day in December, when a sleigh was moving slowly up one of the mountains in the district we have described. The day had been fine for the season, and but 2 or 3 large clouds, whose color seemed brightened by the light reflected from the mass of snow that covered the earth, floated in a sky of the purest blue. The road wound along the brow of a precipice, and on one side was upheld by a foundation of logs piled one upon the other, while a narrow excavation in the mountain in the opposite direction had made a passage of sufficient width for the ordinary traveling of that day. But logs, excavation, and everything that did not reach several feet above the earth lay alike buried beneath the snow. A single track, barely wide enough to receive the sleigh, denoted the route of the highway, and this was sunk nearly 2 feet below the surrounding surface. Sleigh is the word used in every part of the United States to denote a traineau. It is of local use in the west of England, whence it is most probably derived by the Americans. The latter draw a distinction between a sled, or sledge, and a sleigh, the sleigh being shod with metal. Sleighs are also subdivided into 2-horse and 1-horse sleighs. Of the latter, there are the cutter, with tills so arranged as to permit the horse to travel in the side track, the pung, or toe pung, which is driven with a pole, and the gumper, a rude construction used for temporary purposes in the new countries. Many of the American sleighs are elegant, though the use of this mode of conveyance is much lessened with amelioration of the climate consequent to the clearing of the forests. In the vale, which lay at a distance of several hundred feet lower, there was what, in the language of the country, was called a clearing, and all the usual improvements of a new settlement. These even extended up the hill to the point where the road turned short and ran across the level land, which lay on the summit of the mountain, but the summit itself remained in the forest. There was glittering in the atmosphere, as if it was filled with innumerable shining particles, and the noble bay horses that drew the sleigh were covered, in many parts with a coat of hoarfrost. The vapor from their nostrils was seen to issue like smoke, and every object in the view, as well as every arrangement of the travelers, denoted the depth of the winter in the mountains. The harness, which was of a deep, dull black, differing from the glossy varnishing of the present day, was ornamented with enormous plates and buckles of brass, that shone like gold in those transient beams of the sun which found their way obliquely through the tops of the trees. Huge saddles, studded with nails and fitted with cloth that served as blankets to the shoulders of the cattle, supported four high, square-topped turrets, through which the stout reins led from the mouths of the horses to the hands of the driver, who was a Negro, of apparently 20 years of age. His face, which nature had colored with a glistening black, was now mottled with the cold, and his large shining eyes filled with tears, a tribute to its power that the keen frosts of those regions always extracted from one of his African origin. Still, there was a smiling expression of good humor in his happy countenance, that was created by the thoughts of home and a Christmas fireside, with its Christmas frolics. The sleigh was one of those large, comfortable, old-fashioned conveyances, which would admit a whole family within its bosom, but which now contained only two passengers besides the driver. The color of its outside was a modest green, and that of its inside a fiery red. The latter was intended to convey the idea of heat in that cold climate. Large buffalo skins trimmed around the edges with red cloth cut into festoons, covered the back of the sleigh, and were spread over its bottom and drawn up around the feet of the travelers, one of whom was a man of middle age and the other a female just entering upon womanhood. The former was of a large stature, but the precautions he had taken to guard against the cold left but little of his person exposed to view. A greatcoat, that was abundantly ornamented by a profusion of furs, enveloped the whole of his figure excepting the head, which was covered with a cap of marten skins lined with morocco, the sides of which were made to fall, if necessary, and were now drawn close over the ears and fastened beneath his chin with a black ribbon. The top of the cap was surmounted with the tail of the animal whose skin had furnished the rest of the materials, which fell back, not ungracefully, a few inches behind the head. From beneath this mask were to be seen part of a fine, manly face, and particularly a pair of expressive large blue eyes, that promised extraordinary intellect, covert humor, and great benevolence. The form of his companion was literally hid beneath the garments she wore. There were furs and silks peeping from under a large camlet cloak with a thick flannel lining, that by its cut and size was evidently intended for a masculine wearer. A huge hood of black silk, that was quilted with down, concealed the whole of her head, except at a small opening in front for breath, through which occasionally sparkled a pair of animated jet-black eyes. Both the father and daughter, for such was the connection between the two travelers, were too much occupied with their reflections to break a stillness that derived little or no interruption from the easy gliding of the sleigh by the sound of their voices. The former was thinking of the wife that had held this their only child to her bosom, when, 4 years before, she had reluctantly consented to relinquish the society of her daughter in order that the latter might enjoy the advantages of an education which the city of New York could only offer at that period. A few months afterward, death had deprived him of the remaining companion of his solitude, but still he had enough real regard for his child not to bring her into the comparative wilderness in which he dwelt, until the full period had expired to which he had limited her juvenile labors. The reflections of the daughter were less melancholy, and mingled with a pleased astonishment at the novel scenery she met at every turn in the road. The mountain on which they were journeying was covered with pines that rose without a branch some 70 or 80 feet, and which frequently doubled that height by the addition of the tops. Through the innumerable vistas that opened beneath the lofty trees, the eye could penetrate until it was met by a distant inequality in the ground, or was stopped by a view of the summit of the mountain which lay on the opposite side of the valley to which they were hastening. The dark trunks of the trees rose from the pure white of the snow in regularly formed shafts, until, at a great height, their branches shot forth horizontal limbs, that were covered with the meager foliage of an evergreen, affording a melancholy contrast to the torpor of nature below. To the travelers there seemed to be no wind, but these pines waved majestically at their topmost boughs, sending forth a dull, plaintive sound that was quite in consonance with the rest of the melancholy scene. The sleigh had glided for some distance along the even surface, and the gaze of the female was bent in inquisitive and, perhaps, timid glances into the recesses of the forest, when a loud and continued howling was heard, pealing under the long arches of the woods like the cry of a numerous pack of hounds. The instant the sounds reached the ear of the gentleman he cried aloud to the black. "Hole up, Aggie, there is old Hector, I should know his bay among 10,000. The Leatherstocking has put his hounds into the hills this clear day, and they have started their game. There is a deer track a few rods ahead, and now, Bess, if thou canst muster courage enough to stand fire, I will give thee a saddle for thy Christmas dinner." The black drew up, with a cheerful grin upon his chilled features, and began thrashing his arms together in order to restore the circulation of his fingers, while the speaker stood erect and, throwing aside his outer covering, stepped from the sleigh upon a bank of snow which sustained his weight without yielding. In a few moments the speaker succeeded in extricating a double-barreled fowling piece from among a multitude of trunks and bandboxes. After throwing aside the thick mittens which had encased his hands, there now appeared a pair of leather gloves tipped with fur. He examined his priming, and was about to move forward, when the light bounding noise of an animal plunging through the woods was heard, and a fine buck darted into the path a short distance ahead of him. The appearance of the animal was sudden, and his flight inconceivably rapid, but the traveler appeared to be too keen a sportsman to be disconcerted by either. As it came first into view he raised the fowling piece to his shoulder and, with a practiced eye and steady hand, drew a trigger. The deer dashed forward undaunted, and apparently unhurt. Without lowering his piece, the traveler turned its muzzle toward his victim, and fired again. Neither discharge, however, seemed to have taken effect. The whole scene had passed with a rapidity that confused the female, who was unconsciously rejoicing in the escape of the buck, as he rather darted like a meteor than ran across the road, when a sharp, quick sound struck her ear, quite different from the full, round reports of her father's gun, but still sufficiently distinct to be known as the concussion produced by firearms. At the same instant that she heard this unexpected report, the buck sprang from the snow to a great height in the air, and directly a second discharge, similar in sound to the first, followed, when the animal came to the earth, failing headlong and rolling over on the crust with its own velocity. A loud shot was given by the unseen marksman, and a couple of men instantly appeared from behind the trunks of two of the pines, where they had evidently placed themselves in expectation of the passage of the deer. "Ha! Natty, had I known you were in ambush, I should not have fired," cried the traveler, moving toward the spot where the deer lay near to which he was followed by the delighted black, with his sleigh, but the sound of old Hector was too exhilarating to be quiet, though I hardly think I struck him, either. "No, no, Judge," returned the hunter, with an inward chuckle, and with that look of exultation that indicates a consciousness of superior skill, "you burnt your powder only to warm your nose this cold evening. Did ye think to stop a full-grown buck, with Hector in the slot open upon him within sound, with that popgun in your hand? There's plenty of pheasants among the swamps, and the snowbirds are flying round your own door, where you may feed them with crumbs, and shoot them at pleasure, any day, but if you're for a buck, or a little bear's meat, Judge, you'll have to take the long rifle, with a greased wadding, or you'll waste more powder than you'll fill stomachs, I'm thinking." As the speaker concluded he drew his bare hand across the bottom of his nose, and again opened his enormous mouth with a kind of inward laugh. "The gun scatters well, Natty, and it has killed a deer before now," said the traveler, smiling good-humoredly. "One barrel was charged with buckshot, but the other was loaded for birds only. Here are two hurts, one through the neck, and the other directly through the heart. It is by no means certain, Natty, but I gave him one of the two." "Let who will kill him?" said the hunter, rather surlily. "I suppose the creature is to be eaten." So saying, he drew a large knife from a leathern sheath, which was stuck through his girdle, or sash, and cut the throat of the animal. "If there are two balls through the deer, I would ask if there weren't two rifles fired besides. Whoever saw such a ragged hole from a smoothbore as this through the neck? And you will own yourself, Judge, that the buck fell at the last shot, which was sent from a truer and a younger hand than yourn or mine either. But, for my part, although I am a poor man I can live without the venison, but I don't love to give up my lawful dues in a free country. Though, for the matter of that, might often makes right here, as well as in the old country, for what I can see." An air of sullen dissatisfaction pervaded the manner of the hunter during the whole of his speech, yet he thought it prudent to utter the close of the sentence in such an undertone as to leave nothing audible but the grumbling sounds of his voice. "Nay, Natty," rejoined the traveler, with undisturbed good humor, "it is for the honor that I contend. A few dollars will pay for the venison, but what will requite me for the lost honor of a buck's tail in my cap? Think, Natty, how I should triumph over that quizzing dog, Dick Jones, who has failed 7 times already this season, and has only brought in 1 woodchuck and a few gray squirrels. Ah! The game is becoming hard to find, indeed, Judge, with your clearings and betterments," said the old hunter, with a kind of compelled resignation. "The time has been when I have shot 13 deer without counting the fans standing in the door of my own hut, and for bear's meat, if one wanted a ham or so, he had only to watch 8 nights, And he could shoot one by moonlight, through the cracks of the logs, no fear of his oversleeping himself neither, for the howling of the wolves was sardine to keep his eyes open. There's old Hector patting with affection a tall hound of black and yellow spots, with white belly and legs, that just then came in on the scent, accompanied by the slut he had mentioned. See where the wolves bit his throat, the night I drove them from the venison that was smoking on the chimney top. The dog is more to be trusted than many a Christian man, for he never forgets a friend, and loves the hand that gives him bread. There was a peculiarity in the manner of the hunter that attracted the notice of the young female, who had been a close and interested observer of his appearance and equipments, from the moment he came into view. He was tall, and so meager as to make him seem above even the 6 feet that he actually stood in his stockings. On his head, which was thinly covered with lank, sandy hair, he wore a cap made of fox skin, resembling in shape the one we have already described, although much inferior in finish and ornaments. His face was skinny and thin almost to emaciation, but yet it bore no signs of disease. On the contrary, it had every indication of the most robust and enduring health. The cold and exposure had, together, given it a color of uniform red. His gray eyes were glancing under a pair of shaggy brows, that overhung them in long hairs of gray mingled with their natural hue. His scraggy neck was bare, and burned to the same tint with his face, though a small part of a shirt collar, made of the country check, was to be seen above the overdress he wore. A kind of coat, made of dressed deerskin, with the hair on, was belted close to his lank body by a girdle of colored worsted. On his feet were deerskin moccasins, ornamented with porcupine's quills, after the manner of the Indians, and his limbs were guarded with long leggings of the same material as the moccasins, which, gartering over the knees of his tarnished buckskin breeches, had obtained for him among the settlers the nickname of Leatherstocking. Over his left shoulder was slung a belt of deerskin, from which depended an enormous ox horn, so thinly scraped as to discover the powder it contained. The larger end was fitted ingeniously and securely with a wooden bottom, and the other was stopped tight by a little plug. A leathern pouch hung before him, from which, as he concluded his last speech, he took a small measure, and, filling it accurately with powder, he commenced reloading the rifle, which as its butt rested on the snow before him reached nearly to the top of his fox-skin cap. The traveler had been closely examining the wounds during these movements, and now, without heeding the ill humor of the hunter's manner, he exclaimed, "I would fain establish a right, Natty, to the honor of this death, and surely if the hit in the neck be mine it is enough, for the shot in the heart was unnecessary. What we call an act of supererogation, leather stocking. You may call it by what learned name you please, Judge," said the hunter, throwing his rifle across his left arm, and knocking up a brass lid in the breech, from which he took a small piece of greased leather and, wrapping a bale in it, forced them down by main strength on the powder, where he continued to pound them while speaking. "It's far easier to call names than to shoot a buck on the spring, but the creature came by his end from a younger hand than either your nor mine, as I said before. What say you, my friend?" cried the traveler, turning pleasantly to Natty's companion. "Shall we toss up this dollar for the honor, and you keep the silver if you lose? What say you, friend?" "That I killed a deer," answered the young man, with a little haughtiness, as he leaned on another long rifle similar to that of Natty. "Here are 2-1, indeed," replied the judge with a smile. "I am outvoted, overruled, as we say on the bench. There is Aggie, he can't vote, being a slave, and Bess is a minor, so I must even make the best of it. But you'll send me the venison, and the deuce is in it, but I make a good story about its death." "The meat is none of mine to sell," said Leatherstocking, adopting a little of his companion's hauteur. "For my part, I have known animals travel days with shots in the neck, and am none of them who'll rob a man of his rightful dues." "You are tenacious of your rights, this cold evening, Natty," returned the judge with unconquerable good nature. "But what say you, young man, will $3 pay you for the buck?" "First let us determine the question of right to the satisfaction of us both," said the youth firmly but respectfully, and with a pronunciation and language vastly superior to his appearance. "With how many shot did you load your gun?"
"With 5, sir," said the judge, a little struck with the other's manner. "Are they not enough to slay a buck like this?"
"One would do it, but," moving to the tree from behind which he had appeared, "you know, sir, you fired in this direction. Here are 4 of the bullets in the tree." The judge examined the fresh marks in the bark of the pine, and, shaking his head, said with a laugh, "You are making out the case against yourself, my young advocate. Where is the 5th?
"Here," said the youth, throwing aside the rough overcoat that he wore, and exhibiting a hole in his undergarment, through which large drops of blood were oozing.
"Good God!" exclaimed the judge, with horror. "Have I been trifling here about an empty distinction,
and a fellow creature suffering from my hands without a murmur? But hasten quick, get into my sleigh, it is but a mile to the village, where surgical aid can be obtained. All shall be done at my expense, and thou shalt live with me until thy wound is healed, ay, and forever afterward. I thank you for your good intention, but I must decline your offer. I have a friend who would be uneasy were he to hear that I am hurt and away from him. The injury is but slight, and the bullet has missed the bones, but I believe, sir, you will now admit me title to the venison.
Admit it, repeated the agitated judge. I here give thee a right to shoot deer, or bears, or anything thou pleasest in my woods, forever.
Leatherstocking is the only other man that I have granted the same privilege to, and the time is coming when it will be of value. But I buy your deer here, this bill will pay thee, both for thy shot and my own. The old hunter gathered his tall person up into an air of pride during this dialogue, but he waited until the other had done speaking.
There's them living who say that Nathaniel Bumpo's right to shoot on these hills is of older date than Marmaduke Temple's right to forbid him, he said. But if there's a law about it at all, though who ever heard of a law that a man shouldn't kill deer where he pleased? But if there's a law at all, it should be to keep people from the use of smoothbores. A body never knows where his lead will fly, when he pulls the trigger of one of them uncertain firearms. Without attending to the soliloquy of Natty, the youth bowed his head silently to the offer of the banknote, and replied.
Excuse me, I have need of the venison.
But this will buy you many deer, said the judge, take it, I entreat you, and, lowering his voice to a whisper, he added, it is for $100.
For an instant only the youth seemed to hesitate, and then, blushing even through the high color that the cold had given to his cheeks, as if with inward shame at his own weakness, he again declined the offer. During this scene the female arose, and regardless of the cold air, she threw back the hood which concealed her features, and now spoke, with great earnestness.
Surely, surely, young man, sir, you would not pain my father so much as to have him think that he leaves a fellow creature in this wilderness whom his own hand has injured. I entreat you will go with us, and receive medical aid.
Whether his wound became more painful, or there was something irresistible in the voice and manner of the fair pleader for her father's feelings, we know not, but the distance of the young man's manner was sensibly softened by this appeal, and he stood in apparent doubt, as if reluctant to comply with and yet unwilling to refuse her request. The judge, for such being his office must in future be his title, watched with no little interest the display of this singular contention in the feelings of the youth, and, advancing, kindly took his hand, and, as he pulled him gently toward the sleigh, urged him to enter it.
There is no human aid nearer than Templeton, he said, and the hut of Natty is full 3 miles from this. Come, come, my young friend, go with us, and let the new doctor look to this shoulder of thine. Here is Natty will take the tidings of thy welfare to thy friend, and shouldst thou require it, thou shalt return home in the morning. The young man succeeded in extricating his hand from the warm grasp of the judge, but he continued to gaze on the face of the female, who, regardless of the cold, was still standing with her fine features exposed, which expressed feeling that eloquently seconded the request of her father.
Leatherstocking stood, in the meantime, leaning upon his long rifle, with his head turned a little to one side, as if engaged in sagacious musing, when, having apparently satisfied his doubts, by revolving the subject in his mind, he broke silence. It may be best to go, lad, after all, for, if the shot hangs under the skin, my hand is getting too old to be cutting into human flesh, as I once used to, though some 30 years agone, in the old war, when I was out under Sir William, I traveled 70 miles alone in the howling wilderness, with a rifle bullet in my thigh, and then cut it out with my own jackknife. Old Indian John knows the time well. I met him with a party of the Delawares, on the trail of the Iroquois, who had been down and taken 5 scalps on the Schoharie. But I made a mark on the redskin that I warrant he'll carry to his grave. I took him on the post hiram, saving the lady's presence, as he got up from the ambushment, and rattled 3 buckshot into his naked hide, so close that you might have laid a broad joe upon them all. Here Natty stretched out his long neck, and straightened his body, as he opened his mouth, which exposed a single tusk of yellow bone, while his eyes, his face, even his whole frame seemed to laugh, although no sound was emitted except a kind of thick hissing, as he inhaled his breath in quavers. I had lost my bullet mold in crossing the Oneida outlet, and had to make shift with the buckshot, but the rifle was true, and didn't scatter like your two-legged thing there, judge, which don't do, I find, to hunt in company with. Natty's apology to the delicacy of the young lady was unnecessary, for, while he was speaking, she was too much employed in helping her father to remove certain articles of baggage to hear him. Unable to resist the kind urgency of the travelers any longer, the youth, though still with an unaccountable reluctance,
suffered himself to be persuaded to enter the sleigh. The black, with the aid of his master, threw the buck across the baggage and entering the vehicle themselves, the judge invited the hunter to do so likewise.
"No, no," said the old drone, shaking his head, "I have work to do at home this Christmas Eve. Drive on with the boy, and let your doctor look to the shoulder, though if he will only cut out the shot, I have yarbs that will heal the wound quicker than all his foreign ointments." He turned, and was about to move off, when, suddenly recollecting himself, he again faced the party, and added, "If you see anything of Indian John, about the foot of the lake, you had better take him with you, and let him lend the doctor a hand, for, old as he is curious at cuts and bruises, and it's likelier than not he'll be in with brooms to sweep your Christmas hearths."
"Stop, stop," cried the youth, catching the arm of the black as he prepared to urge his horses forward. "Natty, you need say nothing of the shot, nor of where I am going. Remember, Natty, as you love me."
"Trust old Leatherstocking," returned the hunter significantly. "He hasn't lived 50 years in the wilderness, and not learned from the savages how to hold his tongue. Trust to me, lad, and remember old Indian John."
"And, Natty," said the youth eagerly, still holding the black by the arm, "I will just get the shot extracted, and bring you up tonight a quarter of the buck for the Christmas dinner." He was interrupted by the hunter, who held up his finger with an expressive gesture for silence. He then moved softly along the margin of the road, keeping his eyes steadfastly fixed on the branches of a pine. When he had obtained such a position as he wished, he stopped, and, cocking his rifle, threw one leg far behind him, and stretching his left arm to its utmost extent along the barrel of his piece, he began slowly to raise its muzzle in a line with the straight trunk of the tree. The eyes of the group in the sleigh naturally preceded the movement of the rifle, and they soon discovered the object of Natty's aim. On a small dead branch of the pine, which, at the distance of 70 feet from the ground, shot out horizontally, immediately beneath the living members of the tree, sat a bird, that in the vulgar language of the country was indiscriminately called a pheasant or a partridge. In size, it was but little smaller than a common barnyard fowl. The baying of the dogs, and the conversation that had passed near the root of the tree on which it was perched, had alarmed the bird, which was now drawn up near the body of the pine, with the head and neck so erect as to form nearly a straight line with its legs. As soon as the rifle bore on the victim, Natty drew his trigger, and the partridge fell from its height with a force that buried it in the snow.
"Lie down, you old villain," exclaimed Leatherstocking, shaking his ramrod at Hector as he bounded toward the foot of the tree.
"Lie down, I say." The dog obeyed, and Natty proceeded with great rapidity, though with the nicest accuracy, to reload his piece. When this was ended, he took up his game, and, showing it to the party without a head, he cried, "Here is a tidbit for an old man's Christmas. Never mind the venison, boy, and remember Indian John, his yarbs are better than all the foreign ointments. Here, judge," holding up the bird again, "do you think a smooth boar would pick game off their roost, and not ruffle a feather?" The old man gave another of his remarkable laughs, which partook so largely of exultation, mirth, and irony, and, shaking his head, he turned, with his rifle at a trail, and moved into the forest with steps that were between a walk and a trot. At each movement he made his body lowered several inches, his knees yielding with an inclination inward, but, as the sleigh turned at a bend in the road, the youth cast his eyes in quest of his old companion, and he saw that he was already nearly concealed by the trunks of the tree, while his dogs were following quietly in his footsteps, occasionally scenting the deer track, that they seemed to know instinctively was now of no further use to them. Another jerk was given to the sleigh, and Leatherstocking was hid from view. Chapter 2. All places that the eye of heaven visits are to a wise man ports and happy havens. Think not the king did banish thee, but thou the king. Richard II. An ancestor of Marmaduke Temple had, about 120 years before the commencement of our tale, come to the colony of Pennsylvania, a friend and coreligionist of its great patron. Old Marmaduke, for this formidable prenomen was a kind of appellative to the race, brought with him, to that asylum of the persecuted and abundance of the good things of this life. He became the master of many thousands of acres of uninhabited territory, and the supporter of many a score of dependents. He lived greatly respected for his piety, and not a little distinguished as a sectary, was entrusted by his associates with many important political stations, and died just in time to escape the knowledge of his own poverty. It was his lot to share the fortune of most of those who brought wealth with them into the new settlements of the middle colonies. The consequence of an emigrant into these provinces was generally to be ascertained by the number of his white servants or dependents, and the nature of the public situations that he held. Taking this rule as a guide, the ancestor of our judge must have been a man of no little note. It is, however,
a subject of curious inquiry at the present day, to look into the brief records of that early period, and observe how regular, and with few exceptions how inevitable, were the gradations, on the one hand, of the masters to poverty, and on the other, of their servants to wealth. Accustomed to ease, and unequal to the struggles incident to an infant society, the affluent emigrant was barely enabled to maintain his own rank by the weight of his personal superiority and acquirements, but, the moment that his head was laid in the grave, his indolent and comparatively uneducated offspring were compelled to yield precedency to the more active energies of a class whose exertions had been stimulated by necessity. This is a very common course of things, even in the present state of the Union, but it was peculiarly the fortunes of the two extremes of society, in the peaceful and unenterprising colonies of Pennsylvania and New Jersey. The posterity of Marmaduke did not escape the common lot of those who depend rather on their hereditary possessions than on their own powers, and in the third generation they had descended to a point below which, in this happy country, it is barely possible for honesty, intellect and sobriety to fall. The same pride of family that had, by its self-satisfied indolence, conduced to aid their fail, now became a principle to stimulate them to endeavor to rise again. The feeling, from being morbid, was changed to a healthful and active desire to emulate the character, the condition, and, peradventure, the wealth of their ancestors also. It was the father of our new acquaintance, the judge, who first began to reascend in the scale of society, and in this undertaking he was not a little assisted by a marriage, which aided in furnishing the means of educating his only son in a rather better manner than the low state of the common schools of Pennsylvania could promise, or than had been the practice in the family for the two or three preceding generations. At the school where the reviving prosperity of his father was enabled to maintain him, young Marmaduke formed an intimacy with a youth whose years were about equal to his own. This was a fortunate connection for our judge, and paved the way to most of his future elevation in life. There was not only great wealth but high court interest among the connections of Edward Effingham. They were one of the few families then resident in the colonies who thought it a degradation to its members to descend to the pursuits of commerce, and who never emerged from the privacy of domestic life unless to preside in the councils of the colony or to bear arms in her defense. The latter had from youth been the only employment of Edward's father. Military rank under the crown of Great Britain was attained with much longer probation, and by much more toilsome services, 60 years ago than at the present time. Years were passed without murmuring, in the subordinate grades of the service, and those soldiers who were stationed in the colonies felt, when they obtained the command of a company, that they were entitled to receive the greatest deference from the peaceful occupants of the soil. Any one of our readers who has occasion to cross the Niagara may easily observe not only the self-importance, but the real estimation enjoyed by the humblest representative of the crown, even in that polar region of royal sunshine. Such, and at no very distant period, was the respect paid to the military in these states, where now, happily, no symbol of war is ever seen, unless at the free and tearless voice of their people. When, therefore, the father of Marmaduke's friend, after 40 years' service, retired with the rank of major, maintaining in his domestic establishment a comparative splendor, he became a man of the first consideration in his native colony, which was that of New York. He had served with fidelity and courage, and having been, according to the custom of the provinces, entrusted with commands much superior to those to which he was entitled by rank, with reputation also. When Major Effingham yielded to the claims of age, he retired with dignity, refusing his half-pay or any other compensation for services that he felt he could no longer perform. The ministry proffered various civil offices which yielded not only honor but profit, but he declined them all, with the chivalrous independence and loyalty that had marked his character through life. The veteran soon caused this set of patriotic disinterestedness to be followed by another of private munificence, that, however little it accorded with prudence, was in perfect conformity with the simple integrity of his own views. The friend of Marmaduke was his only child, and to this son, on his marriage with a lady to whom the father was particularly partial, the major gave a complete conveyance of his whole estate, consisting of money in the funds, a town and country residence, sundry valuable farms in the old parts of the colony, and large tracts of wild land in the new, in this manner throwing himself upon the filial piety of his child for his own future maintenance. Major Effingham, in declining the liberal offers of the British ministry, had subjected himself to the suspicion of having attained his dotage, by all those who throng the avenues to court patronage, even in the remotest corners of that vast empire, but, when he thus voluntarily stripped himself of his great personal wealth, the remainder of the community seemed instinctively to adopt the conclusion also that he had reached a second childhood. This may explain the fact of his importance rapidly declining, and, if privacy was his object, the veteran had soon a free indulgence of his wishes.
Whatever views the world might entertain of this act of the Major, to himself and to his child it seemed no more than a natural gift by a father of those immunities which he could no longer enjoy or improve, to a son, who was formed, both by nature and education, to do both. The younger Effingham did not object to the amount of the donation, for he felt that while his parent reserved a moral control over his actions, he was relieving himself of a fatiguing burden. Such, indeed, was the confidence existing between them, that to neither did it seem anything more than removing money from one pocket to another. One of the first acts of the young man, on coming into possession of his wealth, was to seek his early friend, with a view to offer any assistance that it was now in his power to bestow. The death of Marmaduke's father, and the consequent division of his small estate, rendered such an offer extremely acceptable to the young Pennsylvanian. He felt his own powers, and saw, not only the excellences, but the foibles in the character of his friend. Effingham was by nature indolent, confiding, and at times impetuous and indiscreet, but Marmaduke was uniformly equable, penetrating, and full of activity and enterprise. To the latter, therefore, the assistance, or rather connection that was proffered to him, seemed to produce a mutual advantage. It was cheerfully accepted, and the arrangement of its conditions was easily completed. A mercantile house was established in the metropolis of Pennsylvania, with the avails of Mr. Effingham's personal property, all, or nearly all, of which was put into the possession of Temple, who was the only ostensible proprietor in the concern, while, in secret, the other was entitled to an equal participation in the profits. This connection was thus kept private for two reasons, one of which, in the freedom of their intercourse, was frankly avowed to Marmaduke, while the other continued profoundly hid in the bosom of his friend. The last was nothing more than pride. To the descendant of a line of soldiers, commerce, even in that indirect manner, seemed a degrading pursuit, but an insuperable obstacle to the disclosure existed in the prejudices of his father. We have already said that Major Effingham had served as a soldier with reputation. On one occasion, while in command on the western frontier of Pennsylvania against a league of the French and Indians, not only his glory, but the safety of himself and his troops were jeoparded by the peaceful policy of that colony. To the soldier, this was an unpardonable offense. He was fighting in their defense. He knew that the mild principles of this little nation of practical Christians would be disregarded by their subtle and malignant enemies, and he felt the injury the more deeply because he saw that the avowed object of the colonists, in withholding their succors, would only have a tendency to expose his command, without preserving the peace. The soldier succeeded, after a desperate conflict, in extricating himself, with a handful of his men, from their murderous enemy. But he never forgave the people who had exposed him to a danger which they left him to combat alone. It was in vain to tell him that they had no agency in his being placed on their frontier at all. It was evidently for their benefit that he had been so placed, and it was their religious duty, so the Major always expressed it, it was their religion's duty to have supported him. At no time was the old soldier an admirer of the peaceful disciples of Fox. Their disciplined habits, both of mind and body, had endowed them with great physical perfection, and the eye of the veteran was apt to scan the fair proportions and athletic frames of the colonists with a look that seemed to utter volumes of contempt for their moral imbecility. He was also a little addicted to the expression of a belief that, where there was so great an observance of the externals of religion, there could not be much of the substance. It is not our task to explain what is or what ought to be the substance of Christianity, but merely to record in this place the opinions of Major Effingham. Knowing the sentiments of the father in relation to this people, it was no wonder that the son hesitated to avow his connection with, nay, even his dependence on the integrity of, a Quaker. It has been said that Marmaduke deduced his origin from the contemporaries and friends of Pennsylvania his father had married without the pale of the church to which he belonged, and had, in this manner, forfeited some of the privileges of his offspring. Still, as young Marmaduke was educated in a colony and society where even the ordinary intercourse between friends was tinctured with the aspect of this mild religion, his habits and language were somewhat marked by its peculiarities. His own marriage at a future day with a lady without not only the pale, but the influence, of this sect of religionists, had a tendency, it is true, to weaken his early impressions. Still he retained them in some degree to the hour of his death, and was observed uniformly, when much interested or agitated, to speak in the language of his youth. But this is anticipating our tale. When Marmaduke first became the partner of young Effingham, he was quite the Quaker in externals, and it was too dangerous an experiment for the son to think of encountering the prejudices of the father on this subject. The connection, therefore, remained a profound secret to all but those who were interested in it. For a few years Marmaduke directed the commercial operations of his house with a prudence and sagacity that afforded rich returns. He married the lady we have mentioned,
who was the mother of Elizabeth, and the visits of his friend were becoming more frequent. There was a speedy prospect of removing the veil from their intercourse, as its advantages became each hour more apparent to Mr. Effingham, when the troubles that preceded the War of the Revolution extended themselves to an alarming degree. Educated in the most dependent loyalty, Mr. Effingham had, from the commencement of the disputes between the colonists and the crown, warmly maintained what he believed to be the just prerogatives of his prince, while, on the other hand, the clear-headed independent mind of Temple had induced him to espouse the cause of the people. Both might have been influenced by early impressions, for, if the son of the loyal and gallant soldier bowed in implicit obedience to the will of his sovereign, the descendant of the persecuted followers of Penn looked back with a little bitterness to the unmerited wrongs that had been heaped upon his ancestors. This difference in opinion had long been a subject of amicable dispute between them, but, latterly, the contest was getting to be too important to admit of trivial discussions on the part of Marmaduke, whose acute discernment was already catching faint glimmerings of the important events that were in embryo. The sparks of dissension soon kindled into a blaze, and the colonies, or rather, as they quickly declared themselves, the States, became a scene of strife and bloodshed for years. A short time before the Battle of Lexington, Mr. Effingham, already a widower, transmitted to Marmaduke, for safekeeping, all his valuable effects and papers, and left the colony without his father. The war had, however, scarcely commenced in earnest, when he reappeared in New York, wearing the livery of his king, and, in a short time, he took the field at the head of a provincial corps. In the meantime, Marmaduke had completely committed himself in the cause, as it was then called, of the Rebel Lion. Of course, all intercourse between the friends ceased on the part of Colonel Effingham. It was unsought, and on that of Marmaduke there was a cautious reserve. It soon became necessary for the latter to abandon the capital of Philadelphia, but he had taken the precaution to remove the whole of his effects beyond the reach of the royal forces, including the papers of his friend also. There he continued serving his country during the struggle, in various civil capacities, and always with dignity and usefulness. While, however, he discharged his functions with credit and fidelity, Marmaduke never seemed to lose sight of his own interests, for, when the estates of the adherents of the crown fell under the hammer, by the acts of confiscation, he appeared in New York, and became the purchaser of extensive possessions at comparatively low prices. It is true that Marmaduke, by thus purchasing estates that had been wrested by violence from others, rendered himself obnoxious to the censures of that sect which, at the same time that it discards its children from a full participation in the family union, seems ever unwilling to abandon them entirely to the world. But either his success, or the frequency of the transgression in others, soon wiped off this slight stain from his character, and, although there were a few who, dissatisfied with their own fortunes, or conscious of their own demerits, would make dark hints concerning the sudden prosperity of the unportioned Quaker, yet his services, and possibly his wealth, soon drove the recollection of these vague conjectures from men's minds. When the war ended, and the independence of the States was acknowledged, Mr. Temple turned his attention from the pursuit of commerce, which was then fluctuating and uncertain, to the settlement of those tracts of land which he had purchased. Aided by a good deal of money, and directed by the suggestions of a strong and practical reason, his enterprise throve to a degree that the climate and rugged face of the country which he selected would seem to forbid. His property increased in a tenfold ratio, and he was already ranked among the most wealthy and important of his countrymen. To inherit this wealth he had but one child, the daughter whom we have introduced to the reader, and whom he was now conveying from school to preside over a household that had too long wanted a mistress. When the district in which his estates lay had become sufficiently populous to be set off as a county, Mr. Temple had, according to the custom of the new settlements, been selected to fill its highest judicial station. This might make a Templar smile, but in addition to the apology of necessity, there is ever a dignity in talents and experience that is commonly sufficient, in any station, for the protection of its possessor, and Marmaduke, more fortunate in his native clearness of mind than the judge of King Charles, not only decided right, but was generally able to give a very good reason for it. At all events, such was the universal practice of the country and the times, and Judge Temple, so far from ranking among the lowest of his judicial contemporaries in the courts of the new counties, felt himself, and was unanimously acknowledged to be, among the first. We shall here close this brief explanation of the history and character of some of our personages, leaving them in future to speak and act for themselves. Chapter 3. All that thou seest is nature's handiwork, those rocks that upward throw their mossy brawl like castled pinnacles of elder times, these venerable stems, that slowly rock their towering branches in the wintry gale, that field of frost, which glitters in the sun, mocking the whiteness of a marble breast.
yet man can mar such works with his rude taste, like some sad spoiler of a virgin's fame.
Duo.
Some little while elapsed ere Marmaduke Temple was sufficiently recovered from his agitation to scan the person of his new companion. He now observed that he was a youth of some 2 or 3 and 20 years of age, and rather above the middle height. Further observation was prevented by the rough overcoat which was belted close to his form by a worsted sash, much like the one worn by the old hunter. The eyes of the judge, after resting a moment on the figure of the stranger, were raised to a scrutiny of his countenance. There had been a look of care visible in the features of the youth, when he first entered the sleigh, that had not only attracted the notice of Elizabeth, but which she had been much puzzled to interpret. His anxiety seemed the strongest when he was enjoining his old companion to secrecy, and even when he had decided, and was rather passively suffering himself to be conveyed to the village, the expression of his eyes by no means indicated any great degree of self-satisfaction at the step. But the lines of an uncommonly prepossessing countenance were gradually becoming composed, and he now sat silent, and apparently musing. The judge gazed at him for some time with earnestness, and then smiling, as if at his own forgetfulness, he said, "I believe, my young friend, that terror has driven you from my recollection. Your face is very familiar, and yet, for the honor of a score of bucks' tails in my cap, I could not tell your name."
"I came into the country but 3 weeks since," returned the youth coldly, "and I understand you have been absent twice that time."
"It will be 5 tomorrow. Yet your face is one that I have seen, though it would not be strange, such has been my affright, should I see thee in thy winding sheet walking by my bedside tonight. What sayst thou, Bess? Am I compos mentis or not? Fit to charge a grand jury, or, what is just now of more pressing necessity, able to do the honors of Christmas Eve in the Hall of Templeton?"
"More able to do either, my dear father," said a playful voice from under the ample enclosures of the hood, "than to kill deer with a smoothbore." A short pause followed, and the same voice, but in a different accent, continued, "We shall have good reasons for our thanksgiving tonight, on more accounts than one." The horses soon reached a point where they seemed to know by instinct that the journey was nearly ended, and, bearing on the bits as they tossed their heads, they rapidly drew the sleigh over the level land which lay on the top of the mountain, and soon came to the point where the road descended suddenly, but circuitously, into the valley. The judge was roused from his reflections, when he saw the 4 columns of smoke which floated above his own chimneys. As house, village, and valley burst on his sight, he exclaimed cheerfully to his daughter, "See, Bess, there is thy resting place for life. And thine too, young man, if thou wilt consent to dwell with us." The eyes of his auditors involuntarily met, and, if the color that gathered over the face of Elizabeth was contradicted by the cold expression of her eye, the ambiguous smile that again played about the lips of the stranger seemed equally to deny the probability of his consenting to form one of this family group. The scene was one, however, which might easily warm a heart less given to philanthropy than that of Marmaduke Temple. The side of the mountain on which our travelers were journeying, though not absolutely perpendicular, was so steep as to render great care necessary in descending the rude and narrow path which, in that early day, wound along the precipices. The negro reined in his impatient steeds, and time was given Elizabeth to dwell on a scene which was so rapidly altering under the hands of man, that it only resembled in its outlines the picture she had so often studied with delight in childhood. Immediately beneath them lay a seeming plain, glittering without inequality, and buried in mountains. The latter were precipitous, especially on the side of the plain, and chiefly in forest. Here and there the hills fell away in long, low points, and broke the sameness of the outline, or setting to the long and wide field of snow, which, without house, tree, fence, or any other fixture, resembled so much spotless cloud settled to the earth. A few dark and moving spots were, however, visible on the even surface, which the eye of Elizabeth knew to be so many sleighs going their several ways to or from the village. On the western border of the plain, the mountains, though equally high, were less precipitous, and as they receded opened into irregular valleys and glens, or were formed into terraces and hollows that admitted of cultivation. Although the evergreens still held dominion over many of the hills that rose on this side of the valley, yet the undulating outlines of the distant mountains, covered with forests of beech and maple, gave a relief to the eye, and the promise of a kinder soil. Occasionally spots of white were discoverable amidst the forests of the opposite hills, which announced, by the smoke that curled over the tops of the trees, the habitations of man and the commencement of agriculture. These spots were sometimes, by the aid of united labor, enlarged into what were called settlements, but more frequently were small and insulated, though so rapid were the changes, and so persevering the labors of those who had cast their fortunes on the success of the enterprise,
that it was not difficult for the imagination of Elizabeth to conceive they were enlarging under her eye while she was gazing, in mute wonder, at the alterations that a few short years had made in the aspect of the country. The points on the western side of this remarkable plain, on which no plant had taken root, were both larger and more numerous than those on its eastern, and one in particular thrust itself forward in such a manner as to form beautifully curved bays of snow on either side. On its extreme end an oak stretched forward, as if to overshadow with its branches a spot which its roots were forbidden to enter. It had released itself from the thraldom that a growth of centuries had imposed on the branches of the surrounding forest trees, and threw its gnarled and fantastic arms abroad, in the wildness of liberty. A dark spot of a few acres in extent at the southern extremity of this beautiful flat, and immediately under the feet of our travelers, alone showed by its rippling surface, and the vapors which exhaled from it, that what at first might seem a plain was one of the mountain lakes, locked in the frosts of winter. A narrow current rushed impetuously from its bosom at the open place we have mentioned, and was to be traced for miles, as it wound its way toward the south through the real valley, by its borders of hemlock and pine, and by the vapor which rose from its warmer surface into the chill atmosphere of the hills. The banks of this lovely basin, at its outlet, or southern end, were steep, but not high, and in that direction the land continued, far as the eye could reach, a narrow but graceful valley, along which the settlers had scattered their humble habitations, with a profusion that bespoke the quality of the soil and the comparative facilities of intercourse. Immediately on the bank of the lake and at its foot, stood the village of Templeton. It consisted of some 50 buildings, including those of every description, chiefly built of wood, and which, in their architecture, bore no great marks of taste, but which also, by the unfinished appearance of most of the dwellings, indicated the hasty manner of their construction. To the eye, they presented a variety of colors. A few were white in both front and rear, but more bore that expensive color on their fronts only, while their economical but ambitious owners have covered the remaining sides of the edifices with a dingy red. One or two were slowly assuming the russet of age, while the uncovered beams that were to be seen through the broken windows of their second stories showed that either the taste or the vanity of their proprietors had led them to undertake a task which they were unable to accomplish. The whole were grouped in a manner that aped the streets of a city, and were evidently so arranged by the directions of one who looked to the wants of posterity rather than to the convenience of the present incumbents. Some three or four of the better sort of buildings, in addition to the uniformity of their color, were fitted with green blinds, which, at that season at least, were rather strangely contrasted to the chill aspect of the lake, the mountains, the forests, and the wide fields of snow. Before the doors of these pretending dwellings were placed a few saplings, either without branches or possessing only the feeble shoots of one or two summer's growth, that looked not unlike tall grenadiers on post near the threshold of princes. In truth, the occupants of these favored habitations were the nobles of Templeton, as Marmaduke was its king. They were the dwellings of two young men who were cunning in the law, an equal number of that class who chaffered to the wants of the community under the title of storekeepers, and a disciple of Aesculapius, who, for a novelty, brought more subjects into the world than he sent out of it. In the midst of this incongruous group of dwellings rose the mansion of the judge, towering above all its neighbors. It stood in the center of an enclosure of several acres, which was covered with fruit trees. Some of the latter had been left by the Indians, and began already to assume the moss and inclination of age, therein forming a very marked contrast to the infant plantations that peered over most of the picketed fences of the village. In addition to this show of cultivation were two rows of young Lombardy poplars, a tree but lately introduced into America, formerly lining either side of a pathway which led from a gate that opened on the principal street to the front door of the building. The house itself had been built entirely under the superintendence of a certain Mr. Richard Jones, whom we have already mentioned, and who, from his cleverness in small matters, and an entire willingness to exert his talents, added to the circumstance of their being sisters' children, ordinarily superintended all the minor concerns of Marmaduke Temple. Richard was fond of saying that this child of invention consisted of nothing more nor less than what should form the groundwork of every clergyman's discourse, viz., a firstly and a lastly. He had commenced his labors, in the first year of their residence, by erecting a tall, gaunt edifice of wood, with its gable toward the highway. In this shelter, for it was little more, the family resided 3 years. By the end of that period, Richard had completed his design. He had availed himself, in this heavy undertaking, of the experience of a certain wandering Eastern mechanic, who, by exhibiting a few soiled plates of English architecture, and talking learnedly of friezes, entablatures, and particularly of the composite order, had obtained a very undue influence over Richard's taste in everything that pertained to that branch of the fine arts. Not that Mr. Jones did not affect to consider Hiram Doolittle a perfect empiric in his profession,
being in the constant habit of listening to his treatises on architecture with a kind of indulgent smile, yet, either from an inability to oppose them by anything plausible from his own stores of learning or from secret admiration, Richard generally submitted to the arguments of his coadjutor. Together, they had not only erected a dwelling for Marmaduke, but they had given a fashion to the architecture of the whole county. The composite order, Mr. Doolittle would contend, was an order composed of many others, and was intended to be the most useful of all, for it admitted into its construction such alterations as convenience or circumstances might require. To this proposition Richard usually assented, and when rival geniuses who monopolize not only all the reputation but most of the money of a neighborhood, are of a mind, it is not uncommon to see them lead the fashion, even in graver matters. In the present instance, as we have already hinted, the castle, as Judge Templeton's dwelling was termed in common parlance, came to be the model, in some one or other of its numerous excellences, for every aspiring edifice within 20 miles of it. The house itself, or the lastly, was of stone, large, square, and far from uncomfortable. These were four requisites, on which Marmaduke had insisted with a little more than his ordinary pertinacity. But everything else was peaceably assigned to Richard and his associate. These worthies found the material a little too solid for the tools of their workmen, which, in general, were employed on a substance no harder than the white pine of the adjacent mountains, a wood so proverbially soft that it is commonly chosen by the hunters for pillows. But for this awkward dilemma, it is probable that the ambitious tastes of our two architects would have left us much more to do in the way of description. Driven from the faces of the house by the obduracy of the material, they took refuge in the porch and on the roof. The former, it was decided, should be severely classical, and the latter a rare specimen of the merits of the composite order. A roof, Richard contended, was a part of the edifice that the ancients always endeavored to conceal, it being an excrescence in architecture that was only to be tolerated on account of its usefulness. Besides, as he wittily added, a chief merit in a dwelling was to present a front on whichever side it might happen to be seen, for, as it was exposed to all eyes in all weathers, there should be no weak flank for envy or unneighborly criticism to assail. It was therefore decided that the roof should be flat, and with four faces. To this arrangement, Marmaduke objected the heavy snows that lay for months, frequently covering the earth to a depth of 3 or 4 feet. Happily the facilities of the composite order presented themselves to effect a compromise, and the rafters were lengthened, so as to give a descent that should carry off the frozen element. But, unluckily, some mistake was made in the admeasurement of these material parts of the fabric, and, as one of the greatest recommendations of Hiram was his ability to work by the square rule, no opportunity was found of discovering the effect until the massive timbers were raised on the four walls of the building. Then, indeed, it was soon seen that, in defiance of all rule, the roof was by far the most conspicuous part of the whole edifice. Richard and his associate consoled themselves with the relief that the covering would aid in concealing this unnatural elevation, but every shingle that was laid only multiplied objects to look at. Richard essayed to remedy the evil with paint, and four different colors were laid on by his own hands. The first was a sky blue, in the vain expectation that the eye might be cheated into the belief it was the heavens themselves that hung so imposingly over Marmaduke's dwelling. The second was what he called a cloud color, being nothing more nor less than an imitation of smoke. The third was what Richard termed an invisible green, an experiment that did not succeed against a background of sky. Abandoning the attempt to conceal, our architects drew upon their invention for means to ornament the offensive shingles. After much deliberation and 2 or 3 essays by moonlight, Richard ended the affair by boldly covering the whole beneath a color that he christened sunshine, a cheap way, as he assured his cousin the judge, of always keeping fair weather over his head. The platform, as well as the caves of the house, were surmounted by gaudily painted railings, and the genius of Hiram was exerted in the fabrication of divers urns and moldings, that were scattered profusely around this part of their labors. Richard had originally a cunning expedient, by which the chimneys were intended to be so low, and so situated, as to resemble ornaments on the balustrades, but comfort required that the chimneys should rise with the roof, in order that the smoke might be carried off, and they thus became four extremely conspicuous objects in the view. As this roof was much the most important architectural undertaking in which Mr. Jones was ever engaged, his failure produced a correspondent degree of mortification at first. He whispered among his acquaintances that it proceeded from ignorance of the square rule on the part of Hiram, but, as his eye became gradually accustomed to the object, he grew better satisfied with his labors, and instead of apologizing for the defects, he commenced praising the beauties of the mansion house. He soon found hearers, and, as wealth and comfort are at all times attractive, it was, as has been said, made a model for imitation on a small scale. In less than 2 years from its erection,
He had the pleasure of standing on the elevated platform, and of looking down on three humble imitators of its beauty. Thus it is ever with fashion, which even renders the faults of the great subjects of admiration. Marmaduke bore this deformity in his dwelling with great good nature, and soon contrived, by his own improvements, to give an air of respectability and comfort to his place of residence. Still, there was much of incongruity, even immediately about the mansion house. Although poplars had been brought from Europe to ornament the grounds, and willows and other trees were gradually springing up nigh the dwelling, yet many a pile of snow betrayed the presence of the stump of a pine, and even, in one or two instances, unsightly remnants of trees that had been partly destroyed by fire were seen rearing their black, glistening columns 20 or 30 feet above the pure white of the snow. These, which in the language of the country are termed stubs, abounded in the open fields adjacent to the village, and were accompanied, occasionally, by the ruin of a pine or a hemlock that had been stripped of its bark, and which waved in melancholy grandeur its naked limbs to the blast, a skeleton of its former glory. But these and many other unpleasant additions to the view were unseen by the delighted Elizabeth, who, as the horses moved down the side of the mountain, saw only engross the cluster of houses that lay like a map at her feet, the 50 smokes that were curling from the valley to the clouds, the frozen lake as it lay embedded in mountains of evergreen, with the long shadows of the pines on its white surface, lengthening in the setting sun, the dark ribbon of water that gushed from the outlet and was winding its way toward the distant Chesapeake, the altered, though still remembered, scenes of her childhood. 5 years had wrought greater changes than a century would produce in countries where time and labor have given permanency to the works of man. To our young hunter and the judge the scene had less novelty, though none ever emerged from the dark forests of that mountain, and witnessed the glorious scenery of that beauteous valley, as it bursts unexpectedly upon them, without a feeling of delight. The former cast one admiring glance from north to south, and sank his face again beneath the folds of his coat, while the latter contemplated, with philanthropic pleasure, the prospect of affluence and comfort that was expanding around him, the result of his own enterprise, and much of it the fruits of his own industry. The cheerful sound of sleigh bells, however, attracted the attention of the whole party, as they came jingling up the sides of the mountain, at a rate that announced a powerful team and a hard driver. The bushes which lined the highway interrupted the view, and the two sleighs were close upon each other before either was seen. Chapter 4. How now? Whose mare's dead? What's the matter? Falstaff. A large lumber sleigh, drawn by four horses, was soon seen dashing through the leafless bushes which fringed the road. The leaders were of gray, and the pole horses of a jet black. Bells innumerable were suspended from every part of the harness where one of the tinkling balls could be placed, while the rapid movement of the equipage, in defiance of the steep ascent, announced the desire of the driver to ring them to the utmost. The first glance at this singular arrangement acquainted the judge with the character of those in the sleigh. It contained four male figures. On one of those stools that are used at writing desks, lashed firmly to the sides of the vehicle, was seated a little man, enveloped in a greatcoat fringed with fur, in such a manner that no part of him was visible, except a face of an unvarying red color. There was an habitual upward look about the head of this gentleman, as if dissatisfied with its natural proximity to the earth, and the expression of his countenance was that of busy care. He was the charioteer, and he guided the mettled animals along the precipice with a fearless eye and a steady hand. Immediately behind him, with his face toward the other two, was a tall figure, to whose appearance not even the duplicate overcoats which he wore, aided by the corner of a horse blanket, could give the appearance of strength. His face was protruding from beneath a woolen nightcap, and, when he turned to the vehicle of Marmaduke as the sleighs approached each other, it seemed formed by nature to cut the atmosphere with the least possible resistance. The eyes alone appeared to create any obstacle, for from either side of his forehead there light blue, glassy balls projected. The sallow of his countenance was too permanent to be affected even by the intense cold of the evening. Opposite to this personage sat a solid, short, and square figure. No part of his form was to be discovered through his overdress, but a face that was illuminated by a pair of black eyes that gave the lie to every demure feature in his countenance. A fair, jolly wig furnished a neat and rounded outline to his visage, and he, well as the other two, wore marten skin caps. The fourth was a meek-looking, long-visaged man, without any other protection from the cold than that which was furnished by a black surcoat, made with some little formality, but which was rather threadbare and rusty. He wore a hat of extremely decent proportions, though frequent brushing had quite destroyed its nap. His face was pale, and withal a little melancholy, or what might be termed of a studious complexion. The air had given it, just now, a light and somewhat feverish flush, the character of his whole appearance, especially contrasted to the air of humor in his next companion,
was that of habitual mental care. No sooner had the two sleighs approached within speaking distance, than the driver of this fantastic equipage shouted aloud, "Draw up in the quarry, draw up, thou king of the Greeks, draw into the quarry, Agamemnon, or I shall never be able to pass you. Welcome home, cousin Duke, welcome, welcome, black-eyed Bess. Thou seest, Marina Duke, that I have taken the field with an assorted cargo, to do the honor. Monsieur Lacroix has come out with only one cap, old Fritz would not stay to finish the bottle, and Mr. Grant has got to put the lastly to his sermon, yet. Even all the horses would come by the by, judge, I must sell the blacks for you immediately, they interfere, and the nigh one is a bad goer in double harness. I can get rid of them too."
"Sell what thou wilt, Dickon," interrupted the cheerful voice of the judge, "so that thou leavest me my daughter and my lands. And Fritz, my old friend, this is a kind compliment, indeed, for 70 to pay to 45. Monsieur Lacroix, I am your servant. Mr. Grant," lifting his cap, "I feel indebted to your attention. Gentlemen, I make you acquainted with my child. Yours are names with which she is very familiar."
"Welcome, welcome, Chuge," said the elder of the party, with a strong German accent. "Miss Petsy will owe me a kiss."
"And cheerfully will I pay it, my good sir," cried the soft voice of Elizabeth, which sounded, in the clear air of the hills, like tones of silver, amid the loud cries of Richard. "I have always a kiss for my old friend, Major Hartman." By this time the gentleman in the front seat, who had been addressed as Monsieur Lacroix, had risen with some difficulty, owing to the impediment of his overcoats, and steadying himself by placing one hand on the stool of the charioteer, with the other he removed his cap, and bowing politely to the judge and profoundly to Elizabeth, he paid his compliments.
"Cover thy poll, Gaul, cover thy poll," cried the driver, who was Mr. Richard Jones, "cover thy poll, or the frost will pluck out the remnant of thy locks. Had the hairs on the head of Absalom been as scarce as thine, he might have been living to this day." The jokes of Richard never failed of exciting risibility, for he uniformly did honor to his own wit, and he enjoyed a hearty laugh on the present occasion, while Mr. Lacroix resumed his seat with a polite reciprocation in his mirth. The clergyman, for such was the office of Mr. Grant, modestly, though quite affectionately, exchanged his greetings with the travelers also, when Richard prepared to turn the heads of his horses homeward. It was in the quarry alone that he could effect this object, without ascending to the summit of the mountain. A very considerable excavation had been made in the side of the hill, at the point where Richard had succeeded in stopping the sleighs, from which the stones used for building in the village were ordinarily quarried, and in which he now attempted to turn his team. Passing itself was a task of difficulty, and frequently of danger, in that narrow road, but Richard had to meet the additional risk of turning his four in hand. The black civilly volunteered his services to take off the leaders, and the judge very earnestly seconded the measure with his advice. Richard treated both proposals with great disdain.
"Why, and wherefore, cousin Duke?" he exclaimed, a little angrily, "the horses are gentle as lambs. You know that I broke the leaders myself, and the pole horses are too near my whip to be restive. Here is Mr. Lacroix, now, who must know something about driving, because he has rode out so often with me. I will leave it to Mr. Lacroix whether there is any danger." It was not in the nature of the Frenchman to disappoint expectations so confidently formed, although he cat looking down the precipice which fronted him, as Richard turned his leaders into the quarry, with a pair of eyes that stood out like those of lobsters. The German's muscles were unmoved, but his quick sight scanned each movement. Mr. Grant placed his hands on the side of the sleigh, in preparation for a spring, but moral timidity deterred him from taking the leap that bodily apprehension strongly urged him to attempt. Richard, by a sudden application of the whip, succeeded in forcing the leaders into the snowbank that covered the quarry, but the instant that the impatient animals suffered by the crust, through which they broke at each step, they positively refused to move an inch farther in that direction. On the contrary, finding that the cries and blows of their driver were redoubled at this juncture, the leaders backed upon the pole horses, who in their turn backed the sleigh. Only a single log lay above the pile which upheld the road on the side toward the valley, and this was now buried in the snow. The sleigh was easily breed across so slight an impediment, and before Richard became conscious of his danger one half of the vehicle was projected over a precipice, which fell perpendicularly more than 100 feet. The Frenchman, who by his position had a full view of their threatened flight, instinctively threw his body as far forward as possible, and cried, "Oh! Mon cher Monsieur Diac! Mon Dieu! Que faites-vous?
Donner und Blitzen, Richard!" exclaimed the veteran German, looking over the side of the sleigh with unusual emotion, "put you will pre-tear sleigh and kill tear horses.
"Good Mr. Jones," said the clergyman, "be prudent, good sir, be careful."
"Get up, obstinate devils!" cried Richard, catching a bird's eye view of his situation, and in his eagerness to move forward kicking the stool on which he sat. "Get up, I say, Cousin Duke, I shall have to sell the greys too, they are the worst broken horses." Mr. LaCroix Richard was too much agitated to regard his pronunciation, of which he was commonly a little vain. "Monsieur LaCroix, pray get off my leg, you hold my leg so tight that it's no under the horse's back."
"Merciful providence!" exclaimed the judge, "they will be all killed." Elizabeth gave a piercing shriek, and the black of Agamemnon's face changed to a muddy white. At this critical moment, the young hunter, who during the salutations of the parties had sat in rather sullen silence, sprang from the sleigh of Marmaduke to the heads of the refractory leaders. The horses, which were yet suffering under the injudicious and somewhat random blows of Richard, were dancing up and down with that ominous movement that threatens a sudden and uncontrollable start, still pressing backward. The youth gave the leaders a powerful jerk, and they plunged aside, and re-entered the road in the position in which they were first halted. The sleigh was whirled from its dangerous position, and upset, with the runners outward. The German and the divine were thrown, rather unceremoniously, into the highway, but without danger to their bones. Richard appeared in the air, describing the segment of a circle, of which the reins were the radii, and landed, at the distance of some 15 feet, in that snowbank which the horses had dreaded, right end uppermost. Here, as he instinctively grasped the reins, as drowning men seize at straws, he admirably served the purpose of an anchor. The Frenchman, who was on his legs, in the act of springing from the sleigh, took an aerial flight also, much in the attitude which boys assume when they play leapfrog, and, flying off in a tangent to the curvature of his course, came into the snowbank head foremost. Here he remained, exhibiting two lathy legs on high, like scarecrows waving in a cornfield. Major Hartman, whose self-possession had been admirably preserved during the whole evolution, was the first of the party that gained his feet and his voice.
"Terdevil, Rickhart!" he exclaimed in a voice half serious, half comical, "put you unload your sleigh very hootily." It may be doubtful whether the attitude in which Mr. Grant continued for an instant after his overthrow was the one into which he had been thrown, or was assumed, in humbling himself before the power that he reverenced, in thanksgiving at his escape. When he rose from his knees, he began to gaze about him, with anxious looks, after the welfare of his companions, while every joint in his body trembled with nervous agitation. There was some confusion in the faculties of Mr. Jones also, but as the mist gradually cleared from before his eyes, he saw that all was safe, and, with an air of great self-satisfaction, he cried, "Well, that was neatly saved, anyhow. It was a lucky thought in me to hold on to the reins, or the fiery devils would have been over the mountain by this time. How well I recovered myself, Duke! Another moment would have been too late, but I knew just the spot where to touch the Alf leader, that blow under his right flank, and the sudden jerk I gave the rein, brought them round quiet and rule. I must own myself." The spectators, from immemorial usage, have a right to laugh at the casualties of a sleigh ride, and the judge was no sooner certain that no one was done than he made full use of the privilege.
"Thou jerk! Thou recover thyself, Dickon!" he said, "but for that brave lad yonder, thou and thy horses, or rather mine, would have been dashed to pieces. But where is Monsieur LaCroix?"
"Oh! Mon cher juge! Mon ami!" cried a smothered voice, "praise be God, I live. Will you, Mr. Agamemnon, be pleased come down ici, and help me on my leg?"
The divine and the negro seized the incarcerated gull by his legs and extricated him from a snowbank of 3 feet in depth, whence his voice had sounded as from the tombs. The thoughts of Mr. LaCroix, immediately on his liberation, were not extremely collected, and, when he reached the light, he threw his eyes upward, in order to examine the distance he had fallen. His good humor returned, however, with the knowledge of his safety, though it was some little time before he clearly comprehended the case.
"What, monsieur," said Richard, who was busily assisting the black in taking off the leaders, "are you there? I thought I saw you flying toward the top of the mountain just now."
"Praise be God, I no fly down into the lake," returned the Frenchman, with a visage that was divided between pain, occasioned by a few large scratches that he had received in forcing his head through the crust, and the look of complacence that seemed natural to his pliable features.
"Ah! Mon cher Mr. Dieck, that you do next? Dare be noting you no try."
"The next thing, I trust, will be to learn to drive," said the judge, who bad busied himself in throwing the buck, together with several other articles of baggage, from his own sleigh into the snow. "Here are seats for you all, gentlemen, the evening grows piercingly cold, and the hour approaches for the service of Mr. Grant, we will leave friend Jones to repair the damages, with the assistance of Agamemnon, and hasten to a warm fire. Here, Dickon, are a few articles of best trumpery, that you can throw into your sleigh when ready, and there is also a deer of my taking, that I will thank you to bring. Aggie. Remember that there will be a visit from Santa Claus tonight. The periodical visits of St. Nicholas, or Santa Claus, as he is termed, were never forgotten among the inhabitants of New York, until the emigration from New England brought in the opinions and usages of the Puritans, like the Bonhomme de Noël. He arrives at each Christmas. The Black grinned, conscious of the bribe that was offered him for silence on the subject of the deer, while Richard, without in the least waiting for the termination of his cousin's speech, began his reply. "Learn to drive, sayest thou, Cousin Duke? Is there a man in the county who knows more of horseflesh than myself? Who broke in the filly, that no one else dare mount, though your coachman did pretend that he had tamed her before I took her in hand, but anybody could see that he lied he was a great liar, that John what's that, a buck?" Richard abandoned the horses, and ran to the spot where Marmaduke had thrown the deer. "It is a buck. I am amazed. Yes, here are two holes in him, he has fired both barrels, and hit him each time, egod. How Marmaduke will brag. He is a prodigious bragger about any small matter like this now. Well, to think that Duke has killed a buck before Christmas. There will be no such thing as living with him. They are both bad shots though, mere chance now. I never fired twice at a cloven foot in my life. It is hit or miss with me, dead or run away. Had it been a bear, or a wildcat, a man might have wanted both barrels. Here. You Aggie. How far off was the judge when this buck was shot?" "Oh. Massa Richard, maybe a ten or odd," cried the Black, bending under one of the horses, with the pretense of fastening a buckle, but in reality to conceal the grin that opened a mouth from ear to ear. "Ten rod," echoed the other. "Way, Aggie, the deer I killed last winter was a 20s. If anything it was nearer 30 than 20. I wouldn't shoot at a deer a 10 rod. Besides, you may remember, Aggie, I only fired once." "Yes, Massa Richard, I remember 'em. Natty Bumpo fired toter gun. You know, sir, all ye folks say Natty kill him." "The folks lie, you black devil," exclaimed Richard in great heat. "I have not shot even a gray squirrel these 4 years, to which that old rascal has not laid claim, or someone else for him. This is a damned envious world that we live in. People are always for dividing the credit at a thing, in order to bring down merit to their own level. Now they have a story about the patent, that Hiram Doolittle helped to plan the steeple to St. Paul's, when Hiram knows that it is entirely mine, a little taken from a print of his namesake in London, I own, but essentially, as to all points of genius, my own. The grants of land, made either by the crown or the state, were but letters patent under the great seal, and the term patent is usually applied to any district of extent thus conceded, though under the crown, manorial rights being often granted with the soil, in the older counties the word manor is frequently used. There are many manors in New York though all political and judicial rights have ceased. I don't know where he come from, said the Black, losing every mark of humor in an expression of admiration, but everybody say, he wonderful handsome. And well they may say so, Aggie, cried Richard, leaving the buck and walking up to the negro with the air of a man who has new interest awakened within him. I think I may say, without bragging, that it is the handsomest and the most scientific country church in America. I know that the Connecticut settlers talk about their Westerfield meeting house, but I never believe more than half what they say. They are such unconscionable braggers. Just as you have got a thing done, if they see it likely to be successful, they are always for interfering, and then it's tea to one but they lay claim to half, or even all of the credit. You may remember, Aggie, when I painted the sign of the Bold Dragoon for Captain Hollister, there was that fellow, who was about town laying brick dust on the houses, came one day and offered to mix what I call the streaky black, for the tail and mane, and then, because it looks like horsehair, he tells everybody that the sign was painted by himself and Squire Jones. If Marmaduke don't send that fellow off the patent, he may ornament his village with his own hands for me. Here Richard paused a moment, and cleared his throat by a loud hem, while the negro, who was all this time busily engaged in preparing the sleigh, proceeded with his work in respectful silence. Owing to the religious scruples of the judge, Aggie was the servant of Richard, who had his services for a time, and who, of course, commanded a legal claim to the respect of the young negro. But when any dispute between his lawful and his real master occurred, the Black felt too much deference for both to express any opinion. The manumission of the slaves in New York has been gradual. When public opinion became strong in their favor, then grew up a custom of buying the services of a slave, for 6 or 8 years, with the condition to liberate him at the end of the period. Then the law provided that all born after a certain day should be free, the males at 28 and the females at 25. After this, the owner was obliged to cause his servants to be taught to read and write before they reached the age of 18, and, finally, the few that remained were all unconditionally liberated in 1826, or after the publication of this tale. It was quite usual for men more or less connected with the Quakers, who never held slaves, to adopt the first expedient. In the meanwhile, Richard continued watching the Negro as he fastened buckle after buckle, until, stealing a look of consciousness toward the other, he continued, "Now, if that young man who was in your sleigh is a real Connecticut settler, he will be telling everybody how he saved my horses, when, if he had let them alone for half a minute longer, I would have brought them in much better, without upsetting, with the whip amid rain it spoils a horse to give him his heel. I should not wonder if I had to sell the whole team, just for that one jerk he gave them." Richard paused and hemmed, for his conscience smote him a little for censuring a man who had just saved his life. "Who is the lad, Aggie? I don't remember to have seen him before." The black recollected the hint about Santa Claus, and, while he briefly explained how they had taken up the person in question on the top of the mountain, he forbore to add anything concerning the accident or the wound, only saying that he believed the youth was a stranger. It was so usual for men of the first rank to take into their sleighs anyone they found toiling through the snow, that Richard was perfectly satisfied with his explanation. He heard Aggie with great attention, and then remarked, "Well, if the lad has not been spoiled by the people in Templeton, he may be a modest young man, and, as he certainly meant well, I shall take some notice of him. Perhaps he is land hunting, I say, Aggie, maybe he is out hunting?"
"Eh?
Yes, Massa Richard," said the black, a little confused, for, as Richard did all the flogging, he stood in great terror of his master. "In the main, yes, sir, I believe he be."
"Had he a pack and an axe?"
"No, sir, only he rifle."
"Rifle!" exclaimed Richard, observing the confusion of the Negro, which now amounted to terror. "By Jove, he killed the deer. I knew that Marmaduke couldn't kill a buck on the jump. How was it, Aggie? Tell me all about it, and I'll roast Duke quicker than he can roast his saddle. How was it, Aggie?"
"The lad shot the buck, and the judge bought it, ha!
And he is taking the youth down to get the pay?"
The pleasure of this discovery had put Richard in such a good humor, that the Negro's fears in some measure vanished, and he remembered the stocking of Santa Claus. After a gulp or two, he made out to reply,
"You forget a two-shot, sir?"
"Don't lie, you black rascal!" cried Richard, stepping on the snowbank to measure the distance from his lash to the Negro's back. "Speak truth, or I trounce you." While speaking, the stock was slowly rising in Richard's right hand, and the lash drawing through his left, in the scientific manner with which drummers apply the cat, and Agamemnon, after turning each side of himself toward his master, and finding both equally unwilling to remain there, fairly gave in. In a very few words he made his master acquainted with the truth, at the same time earnestly conjuring Richard to protect him from the displeasure of the lodge.
"I'll do it, boy, I'll do it," cried the other, rubbing his hands with delight.
"Say nothing, but leave me to manage Duke. I have a great mind to leave the deer on the hill, and to make the fellow send for his own carcass. But no, I will let Marmaduke tell a few bounces about it before I come out upon him. Come, hurry in, Aggie, I must help to dress the lad's wound. This Yankee doctor knows nothing of surgery. I had to hold out Milligan's leg for him, while he cut it off." In America the term Yankee is of local meaning. It is thought to be derived from the manner in which the Indians of New England pronounce the word English, or Yankees. New York being originally a Dutch province, the term of course was not known there, and farther south different dialects among the natives themselves probably produced a different pronunciation. Marmaduke and his cousin, being Pennsylvanians by birth, were not Yankees in the American sense of the word. Richard was now seated on the stool again, and, the black taking the hind seat, the steeds were put in motion toward home. As they dashed down the hill on a fast trot, the driver occasionally turned his face to Aggie, and continued speaking, for, notwithstanding their recent rupture, the most perfect cordiality was again existing between them. "This goes to prove that I turned the horses with the reins, for no man who is shot in the right shoulder can have strength enough to bring round such obstinate devils. I knew I did it from the first, but I did not want to multiply words with Marmaduke about it. Will you bite, you villain? Hip, boys, hip. Old Natty, too, that is the best of it. Well, well, Duke will say no more about my deer." And the judge fired both barrels, and hit nothing but a poor lad who was behind a pine tree. "I must help that quack to take out the buckshot for the poor fellow." In this manner Richard descended the mountain, the bells ringing, and his tongue going, until they entered the village, when the whole attention of the driver was devoted to a display of his horsemanship, to the admiration of all the gaping women and children who thronged the windows to witness the arrival of their landlord and his daughter. Chapter 5. Nathaniel's coat, sir, was not fully made, and Gabriel's pumps were all unpinked ith heel, there was no link to color Peter's hat, and Walter's dagger was not come from sheathing, there were none fine, but Adam, Ralph, and Gregory. Shakespeare. After winding along the side of the mountain, the road, on reaching the gentle declivity which lay at the base of the hill, turned at a right angle to its former course, and shot down an inclined plane, directly into the village of Templeton. The rapid little stream that we have already mentioned was crossed by a bridge of hewn timber, which manifested, by its rude construction and the unnecessary size of its framework, both the value of labor and the abundance of materials. This little torrent, whose dark waters gushed over the limestones that lined its bottom, was nothing less than one of the many sources of the Susquehanna, a river to which the Atlantic herself has extended an arm in welcome. It was at this point that the powerful team of Mr. Jones brought him up to the more sober steeds of our travelers. A small hill was risen, and Elizabeth found herself at once amidst the incongruous dwellings of the village. The street was of the ordinary width, notwithstanding the eye might embrace, in one view, thousands and tens of thousands of acres, that were yet tenanted only by the beasts of the forest. But such had been the will of her father, and such had also met the wishes of his followers. To them the road that made the most rapid approaches to the condition of the old, or, as they expressed it, the down countries, was the most pleasant, and surely nothing could look more like civilization than the city, even if it lay in a wilderness. The width of the street, for so it was called, might have been 100 feet, but the track for the sleighs was much more limited. On either side of the highway were piled huge heaps of logs, that were daily increasing rather than diminishing in size, notwithstanding the enormous fires that might be seen through every window. The last object at which Elizabeth gazed when they renewed their journey, after their encounter with Richard, was the sun, as it expanded in the refraction of the horizon, and over whose disk the dark umbrage of a pine was stealing, while it slowly sank behind the western hills. But his setting rays darted along the openings of the mountain he was on, and lighted the shining covering of the birches, until their smooth and glossy coats nearly rivaled the mountainsides in color. The outline of each dark pine was delineated far in the depths of the forest, and the rocks, too smooth and too perpendicular to retain the snow that had fallen, brightened, as if smiling at the leave-taking of the luminary. But at each step as they descended, Elizabeth observed that they were leaving the day behind them. Even the heartless but bright rays of a December sun were missed as they glided into the cold gloom of the valley. Along the summits of the mountains in the eastern range, it is true, the light still lingered, receding step by step from the earth into the clouds that were gathering with the evening mist, about the limited horizon, but the frozen lake lay without a shadow on its bosom, the dwellings were becoming already gloomy and indistinct, and the woodcutters were shouldering their axes and preparing to enjoy, throughout the long evening before them, the comforts of those exhilarating fires that their labor had been supplying with fuel. They paused only to gaze at the passing sleighs, to lift their caps to Marmaduke, to exchange familiar nods with Richard, and each disappeared in his dwelling. The paper curtains dropped behind our travelers in every window, shutting from the air even the firelight of the cheerful apartments, and when the horses of her father turned with a rapid whirl into the open gate of the mansion house, and nothing stood before her but the cold dreary stone walls of the building, as she approached them through an avenue of young and leafless poplars, Elizabeth felt as if all the loveliness of the mountain view had vanished like the fancies of a dream. Marmaduke retained so much of his early habits as to reject the use of bells, but the equipage of Mr. Jones came dashing through the gate after them, sending its jingling sounds through every cranny of the building, and in a moment the dwelling was in an uproar. On a stone platform, of rather small proportions, considering the size of the building, Richard and Hiram had, conjointly, reared four little columns of wood, which in their turn supported the shingled roofs of the portico. This was the name that Mr. Jones had thought proper to give to a very plain, covered entrance. The ascent to the platform was by 5 or 6 stone steps, somewhat hastily laid together, and which the frost had already begun to move from their symmetrical positions, but the evils of a cold climate and a superficial construction did not end here. As the steps lowered, the platform necessarily fell also, and the foundations actually left the superstructure suspended in the air, leaving an open space of a foot between the base of the pillars and the stones on which they had originally been placed. It was lucky for the whole fabric that the carpenter, who did the manual part of the labor, had fastened the canopy of this classic entrance so firmly to the side of the house that, when the base deserted the superstructure in the manner we have described, and the pillars, for the want of a foundation, were no longer of service to support the roof, was able to uphold the pillars. Here was, Indeed, an unfortunate gap left in the ornamental part of Richard's column, but, like the window in Aladdin's palace, it seemed only left in order to prove the fertility of its master's resources. The composite order again offered its advantages, and a second edition of the base was given, as the booksellers say, with additions and improvements. It was necessarily larger, and it was properly ornamented with moldings, still the steps continued to yield, and, at the moment when Elizabeth returned to her father's door, a few rough wedges were driven under the pillars to keep them steady, and to prevent their weight from separating them from the pediment which they ought to have supported. From the great door which opened into the porch emerged two or three female domestics, and one male. The latter was bareheaded, but evidently more dressed than usual, and on the whole was of so singular a formation and attire as to deserve a more minute description. He was about 5 feet in height, of a square and athletic frame, with a pair of shoulders that would have fitted a grenadier. His low stature was rendered the more striking by a bend forward that he was in the habit of assuming, for no apparent reason, unless it might be to give greater freedom to his arms, in a particularly sweeping swing, that they constantly practiced when their master was in motion. His face was long, of a fair complexion, burnt to a fiery red, with a snub nose, cocked into an inveterate pug, a mouth of enormous dimensions, filled with fine teeth, and a pair of blue eyes, that seemed to look about them on surrounding objects with habitual contempt. His head composed full 1/4 of his whole length, and the queue that depended from its rear occupied another. He wore a coat of very light drab cloth, with buttons as large as dollars, bearing the impression of a foul anchor. The skirts were extremely long, reaching quite to the calf, and were broad in proportion. Beneath, there were a vest and breeches of red plush, somewhat worn and soiled. He had shoes with large buckles, and stockings of blue and white stripes. This odd-looking figure reported himself to be a native of the county of Cornwall, in the island of Great Britain. His boyhood had passed in the neighborhood of the tin mines, and his youth as the cabin boy of a smuggler, between Falmouth and Guernsey. From this trade he had been impressed into the service of his king, and, for the want of a better, had been taken into the cabin, first as a servant, and finally as steward to the captain. Here he acquired the art of making chowder, lobster, and one or two other sea dishes, and, as he was fond of saying, had an opportunity of seeing the world. With the exception of one or two outports in France, and an occasional visit to Portsmouth, Plymouth, and Deal, he had in reality seen no more of mankind, however, than if he had been riding a donkey in one of his native mines. But, being discharged from the navy at the peace of 83, he declared that, as he had seen all the civilized parts of the earth, he was inclined to make a trip to the wilds of America. We will not trace him in his brief wanderings, under the influence of that spirit of emigration that sometimes induces a dapper cockney to quit his home, and lands him, before the sound of Bow Bells is out of his ears, within the roar of the cataract of Niagara, but shall only add that at a very early day, even before Elizabeth had been sent to school, he had found his way into the family of Marmaduke Temple, where, owing to a combination of qualities that will be developed in the course of the tale, he held, under Mr. Jones, the office of Major Domo. The name of this worthy was Benjamin Penguillan, according to his own pronunciation, but, owing to a marvelous tale that he was in the habit of relating, concerning the length of time he had to labor to keep his ship from sinking after Rodney's victory, he had universally acquired the nickname of Ben Pump. By the side of Benjamin, and pressing forward as if a little jealous of her station, stood a middle-aged woman, dressed in calico, rather violently contrasted in color with a tall, meager, shapeless figure, sharp features, and a somewhat acute expression of her physiognomy. Her teeth were mostly gone, and what did remain were of a tight yellow. The skin of her nose was drawn tightly over the member, to hang in large wrinkles in her cheeks and about her mouth. She took snuff in such quantities as to create the impression that she owed the saffron of her lips and the adjacent parts to this circumstance, but it was the unvarying color of her whole face. She presided over the female part of the domestic arrangements, in the capacity of housekeeper, was a spinster, and bore the name of Remarkable Pettibone. To Elizabeth she was an entire stranger, having been introduced into the family since the death of her mother. In addition to these, were three or four subordinate menials, mostly black, some appearing at the principal door, and some running from the end of the building, where stood the entrance to the cellar kitchen. Besides these, there was a general rush from Richard's kennel, accompanied with every canine tone from the howl of the wolf dog to the petulant bark of the terrier. The master received their boisterous salutations with a variety of imitations from his own throat, when the dogs, probably from shame of being outdone, ceased their outcry. One stately, powerful mastiff, who wore round his neck a brass collar, with him, T, engraved in large letters on the rim, alone was silent.
He walked majestically, amid the confusion, to the side of the judge, where, receiving a kind pat or two, he turned to Elizabeth, who even stooped to kiss him, as she called him kindly by the name of Old Brave. The animal seemed to know her, as she ascended the steps, supported by Monsieur Lacroix and her father, in order to protect her from falling on the ice with which they were covered. He looked wistfully after her figure, and when the door closed on the whole party, he laid himself in a kennel that was placed nearby, as if conscious that the house contained something of additional value to guard. Elizabeth followed her father, who paused a moment to whisper a message to one of his domestics, into a large hall, that was dimly lighted by two candles, placed in high, old-fashioned, brass candlesticks. The door closed, and the party were at once removed from an atmosphere that was nearly at zero, to one of 60 degrees above. In the center of the hall stood an enormous stove, the sides of which appeared to be quivering with heat, from which a large, straight pipe, leading through the ceiling above, carried off the smoke. An iron basin, containing water, was placed on this furnace, for such only it could be called, in order to preserve a proper humidity in the apartment. The room was carpeted, and furnished with convenient, substantial furniture, some of which was brought from the city, the remainder having been manufactured by the mechanics of Templeton. There was a sideboard of mahogany, inlaid with ivory, and bearing enormous handles of glittering brass, and groaning under the piles of silver plate. Near it stood a set of prodigious tables, made of the wild cherry, to imitate the imported wood of the sideboard, but plain and without ornament of any kind. Opposite to these stood a smaller table, formed from a lighter colored wood, through the grains of which the wavy lines of the curled maple of the mountains were beautifully undulating. Near to this, in a corner, stood a heavy, old-fashioned, brass-faced clock, encased in a high box, of the dark hue of the black walnut from the seashore. An enormous settee, or sofa, covered with light chintz, stretched along the walls for nearly 20 feet on one side of the hall, and chairs of wood, painted a light yellow, with black lines that were drawn by no very steady hand, were ranged opposite, and in the intervals between the other pieces of furniture. A Fahrenheit thermometer in a mahogany case, and with a barometer annexed, was hung against the wall, at some little distance from the stove, which Benjamin consulted, every half hour, with prodigious exactitude. Two small glass chandeliers were suspended at equal distances between the stove and outer doors, one of which opened at each end of the hall, and gilt lusters were affixed to the framework of the numerous side doors that led from the apartment. Some little display in architecture had been made in constructing these frames and casings, which were surmounted with pediments, that bore each a little pedestal in its center. On these pedestals were small busts in blacked plaster of Paris. The style of the pedestals as well as the selection of the busts were all due to the taste of Mr. Jones. On one stood Homer, a most striking likeness, Richard affirmed, as anyone might see, for it was blind. Another bore the image of a smooth-visaged gentleman with a pointed beard, whom he called Shakespeare. A third ornament was an urn, which, from its shape, Richard was accustomed to say, intended to represent itself as holding the ashes of Dido. A fourth was certainly old Franklin, in his cap and spectacles. A fifth as surely bore the dignified composure of the face of Washington. A sixth was a nondescript, representing a man with a shirt collar open, to use the language of Richard, with a laurel on his head. It was Julius Caesar or Dr. Faustus. There were good reasons for believing either. The walls were hung with a dark lead-colored English paper that represented Britannia weeping over the tomb of Wolfe. The hero himself stood at a little distance from the mourning goddess, and at the edge of the paper. Each width contained the figure, with the slight exception of one arm of the general, which ran over on the next piece, so that when Richard essayed, with his own hands, to put together this delicate outline, some difficulties occurred that prevented a nice conjunction, and Britannia had reason to lament, in addition to the loss of her favorite's life, numberless cruel amputations of his right arm. The luckless cause of these unnatural divisions now announced his presence in the hall by a loud crack of his whip. "Why, Benjamin! You Ben Pump! Is this the manner in which you received the heiress?" he cried. "Excuse him, Cousin Elizabeth. The arrangements were too intricate to be trusted to everyone, but now I am here, things will go on better. Come, light up, Mr. Penguillan, light up, and let us see one another's faces. Well, Duke, I have brought home your dear, what is to be done with it, ha?" "By the Lord, Squire," commenced Benjamin, in reply, first giving his mouth a wipe with the back of his hand, "if this here thing had been ordered sumat earlier in the day, it might have been got up, d'ye see, to your liking. I had mustered all hands and was exercising candles, when you hove in sight, but when the women heard your bells they started an end, as if they were riding the boatswain's colt,
And if so be there is that man in the house who can bring up a parcel of women when they have got headway on them, until they've run out the end of their rope, his name is not Benjamin Pump. But Miss Betsy here must have altered more than a privateer in disguise, since she has got on her woman's duds, if she will take offense with an old fellow for the small matter of lighting a few candles. Elizabeth and her father continued silent, for both experienced the same sensation on entering the hall. The former had resided 1 year in the building before she left home for school, and the figure of its lamented mistress was missed by both husband and child. But candles had been placed in the chandeliers and lusters, and the attendants were so far recovered from surprise as to recollect their use. The oversight was immediately remedied, and in a minute the apartment was in a blaze of light. The slight melancholy of our heroine and her father was banished by this brilliant interruption, and the whole party began to lay aside the numberless garments they had worn in the air. During this operation Richard kept up a desultory dialogue with the different domestics, occasionally throwing out a remark to the judge concerning the deer, but as his conversation at such moments was much like an accompaniment on a piano, a thing that is heard without being attended to, we will not undertake the task of recording his diffuse discourse. The instant that remarkable Pettibone had executed her portion of the labor in illuminating, she returned to a position near Elizabeth, with the apparent motive of receiving the clothes that the other threw aside, but in reality to examine, with an air of curiosity not unmixed with jealousy, the appearance of the lady who was to supplant her in the administration of their domestic economy. The housekeeper felt a little appalled, when, after cloaks, coats, shawls, and socks had been taken off in succession, the large black hood was removed, and the dark ringlets, shining like the raven's wing, fell from her head, and left the sweet but commanding features of the young lady exposed to view. Nothing could be fairer and more spotless than the forehead of Elizabeth, and preserved the appearance of life and health. Her nose would have been called Grecian, but for a softly rounded swell, that gave in character to the feature what it lost in beauty. Her mouth, at first sight, seemed only made for love, but, the instant that its muscles moved, every expression that womanly dignity could utter played around it with the flexibility of female grace. It spoke not only to the ear, but to the eye. So much, added to a form of exquisite proportions, rather full and rounded for her years, and of the tallest medium height, she inherited from her mother. Even the color of her eye, the arched brows, and the long silken lashes, came from the same source, but its expression was her father's. Inert and composed, it was soft, benevolent, and attractive, but it could be roused, and that without much difficulty. At such moments it was still beautiful, though it was a little severe. As the last shawl fell aside, and she stood dressed in a rich blue riding habit, that fitted her form with the nicest exactness, her cheeks burning with roses, that bloomed the richer for the heat of the hall, and her eyes lightly suffused with moisture that rendered their ordinary beauty more dazzling, and with every feature of her speaking countenance illuminated by the lights that flared around her, remarkable felt that her own power had ended. The business of unrobing had been simultaneous. Marmaduke appeared in a suit of plain, neat black, Monsieur Lacroix in a coat of snuff color, covering a vest of embroidery, with breeches, and silk stockings, and buckles that were commonly thought to be of paste. Major Hartman wore a coat of sky blue, with large brass buttons, a club wig, and boots, and Mr. Richard Jones had set off his dapper little form in a frock of bottle green, with bullet buttons, by one of which the sides were united over his well-rounded waist, opening above, so as to show a jacket of red cloth, with an undervest of flannel, faced with green velvet, and below, so as to exhibit a pair of buckskin breeches, with long, soiled, white top boots, and spurs, one of the latter a little bent, from its recent attacks on the stool. When the young lady had extricated herself from her garments, she was at liberty to gaze about her, and to examine not only the household over which she was to preside, but also the air and manner in which the domestic arrangements were conducted. Although there was much incongruity in the furniture and appearance of the hall, there was nothing mean. The floor was carpeted, even in its remotest corners. The brass candlesticks, the gilt lusters, and the glass chandeliers, whatever might be their keeping as to propriety and taste, were admirably kept as to all the purposes of use and comfort. They were clean and glittering in the strong light of the apartment. Compared with the chill aspect of the December night without, the warmth and brilliancy of the apartment produced an effect that was not unlike enchantment. Her eye had not time to detect, in detail, the little errors which in truth existed, but was glancing around her in delight, when an object arrested her view that was in strong contrast to the smiling faces and neatly attired personages who had thus assembled to do honor to the heiress of Templeton. In a corner of the hall near the grand entrance stood the young hunter, unnoticed, and for the moment apparently forgotten.
But even the forgetfulness of the judge, which, under the influence of strong emotion, had banished the recollection of the wound of this stranger, seemed surpassed by the absence of mind in the youth himself. On entering the apartment, he had mechanically lifted his cap, and exposed a head covered with hair that rivaled, in color and gloss, the locks of Elizabeth. Nothing could have wrought a greater transformation than the single act of removing the rough fox-skin cap. If there was much that was prepossessing in the countenance of the young hunter, there was something even noble in the rounded outlines of his head and brow. The very air and manner with which the member haughtily maintained itself over the coarse and even wild attire in which the rest of his frame was clad, bespoke not only familiarity with a splendor that in those new settlements was thought to be unequaled, but something very like contempt also. The hand that held the cap rested lightly on the little ivory-mounted piano of Elizabeth, with neither rustic restraint nor obtrusive vulgarity. A single finger touched the instrument, as if accustomed to dwell on such places. His other arm was extended to its utmost length, and the hand grasped the barrel of his long rifle with something like convulsive energy. The act and the attitude were both involuntary, and evidently proceeded from a feeling much deeper than that of vulgar surprise. His appearance, connected as it was with the rough exterior of his dress, rendered him entirely distinct from the busy group that were moving across the other end of the long hall, occupied in receiving the travelers and exchanging their welcomes, and Elizabeth continued to gaze at him in wonder. The contraction of the stranger's brows increased as his eyes moved slowly from one object to another. For moments the expression of his countenance was fierce, and then again it seemed to pass away in some painful emotion. The arm that was extended bent and brought the hand nigh to his face, when his head dropped upon it, and concealed the wonderfully speaking lineaments. "We forget, dear sir, the strange gentleman, for her life Elizabeth could not call him otherwise, whom we have brought here for assistance, and to whom we owe every attention." All eyes were instantly turned in the direction of those of the speaker, and the youth rather proudly elevated his head again, while he answered, "My wound is trifling, and I believe that Judge Temple sent for a physician the moment we arrived." "Certainly," said Marmaduke, "I have not forgotten the object of thy visit, young man, nor the nature of my debt." "Oh!" exclaimed Richard, with something of a waggish leer, "thou owest the lad for the venison, I suppose that thou killed, Cousin Duke." "Marmaduke! Marmaduke! That was a marvelous tale of thine about the buck. Here, young man, are $2 for the deer, and Judge Temple can do no less than pay the doctor. I shall charge you nothing for my services, but you shall not fare the worst for that. Come, come, Duke, don't be downhearted about it. If you miss the buck, you contrive to shoot this poor fellow through a pine tree. Now I own that you have beat me, I never did such a thing in all my life. And I hope never will," returned the judge, "if you are to experience the uneasiness that I have suffered, but be of good cheer, my young friend, the injury must be small, as thou movest thy arm with apparent freedom. Don't make the matter worse, Duke, by pretending to talk about surgery," interrupted Mr. Jones, with a contemptuous wave of the hand. "It is a science that can only be learned by practice. You know that my grandfather was a doctor, but you haven't got a drop of medical blood in your veins. These kind of things run in families. All my family by my father's side had a knack at physic. There was my uncle that was killed at Brandywine. He died as easy again as any other man in the regiment, just from knowing how to hold his breath naturally. Few men know how to breathe naturally." "I doubt not, Dickon," returned the judge, meeting the bright smile which, in spite of himself, stole over the stranger's features, "that thy family thoroughly understand the art of letting life slip through their lingers." Richard heard him quite coolly, and putting a hand in either pocket of his surcoat, so as to press forward the skirts, began to whistle a tune, but the desire to reply overcame his philosophy, and with great heat he exclaimed, "You may affect to smile, Judge Temple, at hereditary virtues, if you please, but there is not a man on your patent who don't know better. Here, even this young man, who has never seen anything but bears, and deer, and woodchucks, knows better than to believe virtues are not transmitted in families. Don't you, friend?" "I believe that vice is not," said the stranger abruptly, his eye glancing from the father to the daughter. "The squire is right, Judge," observed Benjamin, with a knowing nod of his head toward Richard, that bespoke the cordiality between them. "Now, in the old country, the King's Majesty touches for the evil, and that is a disorder that the greatest doctor in the fleet, or for the matter of that admiral either, can't cure, only the King's Majesty or a man that's been hanged. Yes, the squire is right, for if so be that he wasn't, how is it that the seventh son always is a doctor, whether he ships for the cockpit or not? Now when we fell in with the Mountaineers, under de Grasse, do you see, we hid aboard of us a doctor." "Very well, Benjamin," interrupted Elizabeth,
glancing her eyes from the hunter to Monsieur Lacroix, who was most politely attending to what fell from each individual in succession. "You shall tell me of that, and all your entertaining adventures together. Just now, a room must be prepared, in which the arm of this gentleman can be dressed."
"I will attend to that myself, Cousin Elizabeth," observed Richard, somewhat haughtily. "The young man will not suffer because Marmaduke chooses to be a little obstinate. Follow me, my friend, and I will examine the hurt myself."
"It will be well to wait for the physician," said the hunter coldly. "He cannot be distant." Richard paused and looked at the speaker, a little astonished at the language, and a good deal appalled at the refusal. He construed the latter into an act of hostility, and, placing his hands in the pockets again, he walked up to Mr. Grant, and, putting his face close to the countenance of the divine, said in an undertone, "Now, mark my words, there will be a story among the settlers, that all our necks would have been broken but for that fellow, as if I did not know how to drive. Why, you might have turned the horses yourself, sir. Nothing was easier. It was only pulling hard on the nirein, and touching the off flank of the leader. I hope, my dear sir, you are not at all hurt by the upset the lad gave us?" The reply was interrupted by the entrance of the village physician. Chapter 6. And about his shelves, a beggarly account of empty boxes, green earthen pots, bladders, and musty seeds. Remnants of packthread, and old cakes of roses, were thinly scattered to make up a show. Shakespeare. Dr. L. Nathan Todd, for such was the name of the man of physic, was commonly thought to be, among the settlers, a gentleman of great mental endowments, and he was assuredly of rare personal proportions. In height he measured, without his shoes, exactly 6 feet and 4 inches. His hands, feet, and knees corresponded in every respect with his formidable stature, but every other part of his frame appeared to have been intended for a man several sizes smaller, if we accept the length of the limbs. His shoulders were square, in one sense at least, being in a right line from one side to the other, but they were so narrow that the long dangling arms they supported seemed to issue out of his back. His neck possessed, in an eminent degree, the property of length to which we have alluded, and it was topped by a small bullet head that exhibited on one side a bush of bristling brown hair and on the other a short, twinkling visage, that appeared to maintain a constant struggle with itself in order to look wise. He was the youngest son of a farmer in the western part of Massachusetts, who, being in somewhat easy circumstances, had allowed this boy to shoot up to the height we have mentioned, without the ordinary interruptions of field labor, wood chopping, and such other toils as were imposed on his brothers. L. Nathan was indebted for this exemption from labor in some measure to his extraordinary growth, which, leaving him pale, inanimate, and listless, induced his tender mother to pronounce him a sickly boy, and one that was not equal to work, but who might earn a living comfortably enough by taking to pleading law, or turning minister, or doctoring, or some such like easy calling. Still, there was great uncertainty which of these vocations the youth was best endowed to fill, but, having no other employment, the stripling was constantly lounging about the homestead, munching green apples and hunting for sorrel, when the same sagacious eye that had brought to light his latent talent seized upon this circumstance as a clue to his future path through the turmoils of the world. L. Nathan was cut out for a doctor, she knew, for he was forever digging for herbs, and tasting all kinds of things that growed about the lots. Then again he had a natural love for doctor stuff, for when she had left the bilious pills out for her man, all nicely covered with maple sugar just ready to take, Nathan had come in and swallowed them for all the world as if they were nothing, while Ichabod, her husband, could never get one down without making such desperate faces that it was awful to look on. This discovery decided the matter. L. Nathan, then about 15, was, much like a wild colt, caught and trimmed by clipping his bushy locks, dressed in a suit of homespun, dyed in the butternut bark, furnished with the New Testament and the Webster's spelling book, and sent to school. As the boy was by nature quite shrewd enough, and had previously, at odd times, laid the foundations of reading, writing, and arithmetic, he was soon conspicuous in the school for his learning. The delighted mother had the gratification of hearing, from the lips of the master, that her son was a prodigious boy, and far above all his class. He also thought that the youth had a natural love for doctoring, as he had known him frequently advise the smaller children against eating too much, and, once or twice, when the ignorant little things had persevered in opposition to L. Nathan's advice, he had known her son empty the school baskets with his own mouth, to prevent the consequences. Soon after this comfortable declaration from his schoolmaster, the lad was removed to the house of the village doctor, a gentleman whose early career had not been unlike that of our hero, where he was to be seen sometimes watering a horse, at others watering medicines, blue, yellow, and red, then again he might be noticed lolling under an apple tree,
with ruddy man's Latin grammar in his hand, and a corner of Denman's midwifery sticking out of a pocket, for his instructor held it absurd to teach his pupil how to dispatch a patient regularly from this world, before he knew how to bring him into it. This kind of life continued for a 12-month, when he suddenly appeared at a meeting in a long coat, and well did it deserve the name, of black homespun, with little booties, bound with an uncolored calfskin for the wad of red morocco. Soon after he was seen shaving with a dull razor. 3 or 4 months had scarce elapsed before several elderly ladies were observed hastening toward the house of a poor woman in the village, while others were running to and fro in great apparent distress. 1 or 2 boys were mounted, bareback, on horses, and sent off at speed in various directions. Several indirect questions were put concerning the place where the physician was last seen, but all would not do, and at length L. Nathan was seen issuing from his door with a very grave air, preceded by a little white-headed boy, out of breath, trotting before him. The following day the youth appeared in the street, as the highway was called, and the neighborhood was much edified by the additional gravity of his air. The same week he bought a new razor, and the succeeding Sunday he entered the meeting house with a red silk handkerchief in his hand, and with an extremely demure countenance. In the evening he called upon a young woman of his own class in life, for there were no others to be found, and, when he was left alone with the fair, he was called, for the first time in his life, Dr. Todd, by her prudent mother. The ice once broken in this manner, L. Nathan was greeted from every mouth with his official appellation. Another year passed under the superintendence of the same master, during which the young physician had the credit of riding with the old doctor, although they were generally observed to travel different roads. At the end of that period, Dr. Todd attained his legal majority. He then took a jaunt to Boston to purchase medicines, and, as some intimated, to walk the hospital. We know not how the latter might have been, but, if true, he soon walked through it, for he returned within a fortnight, bringing with him a suspicious-looking box, that smelled powerfully of brimstone. The next Sunday he was married, and the following morning he entered a one-horse sleigh with his bride, having before him the box we have mentioned, with another filled with homemade household linen, a paper-covered trunk with a red umbrella lashed to it, a pair of quite new saddlebags, and a handbox. The next intelligence that his friends received of the bride and bridegroom was, that the latter was settled in the new countries, and well-to-do as a doctor in Templeton, in York State. If a Templar would smile at the qualifications of Marmaduke to fill the judicial seat he occupied, we are certain that a graduate of Leiden or Edinburgh would be extremely amused with this true narration of the servitude of L. Nathan in the Temple of Aesculapius. But the same consolation was afforded to both the jurist and the leech, for Dr. Todd was quite as much on a level with his own peers of the profession in that country, as was Marmaduke with his brethren on the bench. Time and practice did wonders for the physician. He was naturally humane, but possessed of no small share of moral courage, or, in other words, he was chary of the lives of his patients, and never tried uncertain experiments on such members of society as were considered useful. But, once or twice, when a luckless vagrant had come under his care, he was a little addicted to trying the effects of every file in his saddlebags on the stranger's constitution. Happily their number was small, and in most cases their natures innocent. By these means L. Nathan had acquired a certain degree of knowledge in fevers and agues, and could talk with judgment concerning intermittents, remittents, dirtions, quotidians, etc. In certain cutaneous disorders very prevalent in new settlements, he was considered to be infallible, and there was no woman on the patent but would as soon think of becoming a mother without a husband as without the assistance of Dr. Todd. In short, he was rearing, on this foundation of sand a superstructure cemented by practice, though composed of somewhat brittle materials. He, however, occasionally renewed his elementary studies, and, with the observation of a shrewd mind, was comfortably applying his practice to his theory. In surgery, having the least experience, and it being a business that spoke directly to the senses, he was most apt to distrust his own powers, but he had applied oils to several burns, cut round the roots of sundry defective teeth, and sewed up the wounds of numberless woodchoppers, with considerable éclat, when an unfortunate jobber suffered a fracture of his leg by the tree that he had been felling. It was on this occasion that our hero encountered the greatest trial his nerves and moral feeling had ever sustained. In the hour of need, however, he was not found wanting. Most of the amputations in the new settlements, and they were quite frequent, were performed by some one practitioner who, possessing originally a reputation, was enabled by this circumstance to acquire an experience that rendered him deserving of it, and L. Nathan had been present at 1 or 2 of these operations. But on the present occasion the man of practice was not to be obtained, and the duty fell, as a matter of course, to the share of Mr. Todd. He went to work with a kind of blind desperation, observing, at the same time,
all the externals of decent gravity and great skill. The sufferer's name was Milligan, and it was to this event that Richard alluded when he spoke of assisting the doctor at an amputation by holding the leg. The limb was certainly cut off, and the patient survived the operation. It was, however, 2 years before poor Milligan ceased to complain that they had buried the leg in so narrow a box that it was straightened for room. He could feel the pain shooting up from the inhumed fragment into the living members. Marmaduke suggested that the fault might lie in the arteries and nerves, but Richard, considering the amputation as part of his own handiwork, strongly repelled the insinuation, at the same time declaring that he had often heard of men who could tell when it was about to rain, by the toes of amputated limbs, after 2 or 3 years. Notwithstanding, Milligan's complaints gradually diminished, the leg was dug up, and a larger box furnished, and from that hour no one had heard the sufferer utter another complaint on the subject. This gave the public great confidence in Dr. Todd, whose reputation was hourly increasing, and, luckily for his patients, his information also. Notwithstanding Dr. Todd's practice, and his success with the leg, he was not a little appalled on entering the hall of the Mansion House. It was glaring with the light of day, it looked so imposing, compared with the hastily built and scantily furnished apartments which he frequented in his ordinary practice, and contained so many well-dressed persons and anxious faces, that his usually firm nerves were a good deal discomposed. He had heard from the messenger who summoned him, that it was a gunshot wound, and had come from his own home, wading through the snow, with his saddlebags thrown over his arm, while separated arteries, penetrated lungs, and injured vitals were whirling through his brain, as if he were stalking over a field of battle, instead of Judge Temple's peaceable enclosure. The first object that met his eye, as he moved into the room, was Elizabeth in her riding habit, richly laced with gold cord, her fine form bending toward him, and her face expressing deep anxiety in every one of its beautiful features. The enormous knees of the physician struck each other with a noise that was audible, for, in the absent state of his mind, he mistook her for a general officer, perforated with bullets, hastening from the field of battle to implore assistance. The delusion, however, was but momentary, and his eye glanced rapidly from the daughter to the earnest dignity of the father's countenance, thence to the busy strut of Richard, who was cooling his impatience at the hunter's indifference to his assistance, by pacing the hall and cracking his whip, from him to the Frenchman, who had stood for several minutes unheeded with a chair for the lady, thence to Major Hartman, who was very coolly lighting a pipe 3 feet long by a candle in one of the chandeliers, thence to Mr. Grant, who was turning over a manuscript with much earnestness at one of the lusters, thence to Remarkable, who stood, with her arms demurely folded before her, surveying, with a look of admiration and envy, the dress and beauty of the young lady, and from her to Benjamin, who, with his feet standing wide apart, and his arms akimbo, was balancing his square little body with the indifference of one who is accustomed to wounds and bloodshed. All of these seemed to be unhurt, and the operator began to breathe more freely, but, before he had time to take a second look, the judge, advancing, shook him kindly by the hand, and spoke. "Thou art welcome, my good sir, quite welcome, indeed. Here is a youth whom I have unfortunately wounded in shooting a deer this evening, and who requires some of thy assistance." "Shooting at a deer, Duke," interrupted Richard, "shooting at a deer. Who do you think can prescribe, unless he knows the truth of the case? It is always so with some people, they think a doctor can be deceived with the same impunity as another man." "Shooting at a deer, truly," returned the judge, smiling, "although it is by no means certain that I did not aid in destroying the buck, but the youth is injured by my hand, be that as it may, and it is thy skill that must cure him, and my pocket shall amply reward thee for it." "Two very good things to depend on," observed Monsieur Lacroix, bowing politely, with a sweep of his head to the judge and to the practitioner. "I thank you, monsieur," returned the judge, "but we keep the young man in pain. Remarkable, thou wilt please to provide linen for lint and bandages." This remark caused a cessation of the compliments, and induced the physician to turn an inquiring eye in the direction of his patient. During the dialogue the young hunter had thrown aside his overcoat, and now stood clad in a plain suit of the common, light-colored homespun of the country, that was evidently but recently made. His hand was on the lapels of his coat, in the attitude of removing the garment, when he suddenly suspended the movement, and looked toward the commiserating Elizabeth, who was standing in an unchanged posture, too much absorbed with her anxious feelings to heed his actions. A slight color appeared on the brow of the youth. "Possibly the sight of blood may alarm the lady. I will retire to another room while the wound is dressing." "By no means," said Dr. Todd, who, having discovered that his patient was far from being a man of importance, felt much emboldened to perform the duty. "The strong light of these candles is favorable to the operation,
and it is seldom that we hard students enjoy good eyesight. While speaking, L. Nathan placed a pair of large iron-rimmed spectacles on his face, where they dropped, as it were by long practice, to the extremity of his slim pug nose, and, if they were of no service as assistants to his eyes, neither were they any impediment to his vision, for his little gray organs were twinkling above them like two stars emerging from the envious cover of a cloud. The action was unheeded by all but Remarkable, who observed to Benjamin, "Dr. Todd is a comely man to look on, and does put pretty. How well he seems in spectacles. I declare, they give a grand look to a body's face. I have quite a great mind to try them myself." The speech of the stranger recalled the recollection of Miss Temple, who started as if from deep abstraction, and, coloring excessively, she motioned to a young woman who served in the capacity of maid, and retired with an air of womanly reserve. The field was now left to the physician and his patient, while the different personages who remained gathered around the latter, with faces expressing the various degrees of interest that each one felt in his condition. Major Hartman alone retained his seat, where he continued to throw out vast quantities of smoke, now rolling his eyes up to the ceiling, as if musing on the uncertainty of life, and now bending them on the wounded man, with an expression that bespoke some consciousness of his situation. In the meantime, L. Nathan, to whom the sight of a gunshot wound was a perfect novelty, commenced his preparations with a solemnity and care that were worthy of the occasion. An old shirt was procured by Benjamin, and placed in the hand of the other, who tore divers bandages from it, with an exactitude that marked both his own skill and the importance of the operation. When this preparatory measure was taken, Dr. Todd selected a piece of the shirt with great care, and handing to Mr. Jones, without moving a muscle, said, "Here, Squire Jones, you are well acquainted with these things, will you please to scrape the lint? It should be fine and soft, you know, my dear sir, and be cautious that no cotton gets in, or it may put some the wound. The shirt has been made with cotton thread, but you can easily pick it out." Richard assumed the office, with a nod at his cousin, that said quite plainly, "You see this fellow can't get along without me," and began to scrape the linen on his knee with great diligence. A table was now spread with files, boxes of salve, and divers surgical instruments. As the latter appeared in succession, from a case of red morocco, their owner held up each implement to the strong light of the chandelier, near to which he stood, and examined it with the nicest care. A red silk handkerchief was frequently applied to the glittering steel, as if to remove from the polished surfaces the least impediment which might exist to the most delicate operation. After the rather scantily furnished pocket case which contained these instruments was exhausted, the physician turned to his saddlebags, and produced various phials, filled with liquids of the most radiant colors. These were arranged in due order by the side of the murderous saws, knives, and scissors, when L. Nathan stretched his long body to its utmost elevation, placing his hand on the small of his back as if for support, and looked about him to discover what effect this display of professional skill was likely to produce on the spectators. "Upon my word, doctor," observed Major Hartman, with a roguish roll of his little black eyes, but with every other feature of his face in a state of perfect rest, "put you have a very pretty pocketbook of tools terra, and your doctor stuff glitters as if it was patter for terra eyes as for terra pelly." L. Nathan gave a hem one that might have been equally taken for that kind of noise which cowards are said to make in order to awaken their dormant courage, or for a natural effort to clear the throat, if for the latter it was successful, for, turning his face to the veteran German, he said, "Very true, Major Hartman, very true, sir, a prudent man will always strive to make his remedies agreeable to the eyes, though they may not altogether suit the stomach. It is no small part of our art, sir," and he now spoke with the confidence of a man who understood his subject, "to reconcile the patient to what is for his own good, though at the same time it may be unpalatable." "Sartain. Dr. Todd is right," said Remarkable, "and has scripture for what he says. The Bible tells us how things may be sweet to the mouth, and bitter to the inwards." "True, true," interrupted the judge, a little impatiently, "but here is a youth who needs no deception to lure him.